client's got a blind or something around. Gee, friendly faces out there. Well, let's start at the top. Can you talk to us about number 18, Department of Land Conservation and Development's report?
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Department of Land Conservation, Land Conservation and Development is here today to report on its work plan, and they had been on the January agenda. It was deferred until this meeting of the emergency board, so they were directed by budget note to come back and report on that, and they're here today to do that.
Terrific. Mr. Director, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Pleasure to be with you this morning. As staff reported to you, your 2003 legislator approved a budget note for DLCD that required us to report to the E-Board in January and again in November of this year on progress on completion of a work plan. The legislature also reduced the agency's budget by $375,000 and established that amount in a special purpose appropriation to be allocated in two equal amounts of $187,500 upon demonstration that we have made reasonable progress on the work plan. Another budget note required the Land Conservation and Development Commission to establish a grants advisory committee to develop a grants allocation plan. That note required the department to present the allocation plan to the E-Board before we could be awarded before we could award new grants to local governments. We were prepared to report on the status of progress on the work plan and the grants allocation plan, but this item was removed from the January E-Board agenda, and we're before you here today. We can at this time report to you the progress. I think it's reflected in staff's report. And are pleased to report that we have made reasonable progress, and I would submit to you more than reasonable progress on the work plan that was directed, and so we are asking you for an acknowledgement of that today. And also with regard to the special purpose appropriation, you will note that your staff has recommended allocating a portion of that, that being the special purpose appropriation for grants, to local governments and also for money for landowner notification under Measure 56. We have met with staff and we are in concurrence with that for the purpose of our appearance before the E-Board today. Staff has recommended that the balance of the first half of the special purpose appropriation be in lieu of that being distributed, that the we request and ask for rescheduling vacancy savings of up to that amount, and also noting that if the department believes that it needs all or part of the special purpose appropriation funds, that we may return to a subsequent E-Board meeting. Again, we are in concurrence with that recommendation, so today we are asking you for is the appropriation for the grant funds for local governments. They are depending on those for their planning needs and also for landowner notification under Measure 56 and the program that we're required staff reimbursing local governments for their costs on that end. With regard to a possible return to E-Board on the vacancy savings, I just want to mark a couple of issues, not for today, but for future consideration. One thing to be aware of is that we have been actively trying to recruit positions provided under House Bill 2011 to increase our economic development capacity. That's the bill that involves the department in a very active economic development agenda. That required a couple of positions, new positions to the department, and I will tell you we have gone out two times on those positions and are going on out a third time at this point, still looking for the best candidates for those positions. Part of what appears to be the disincentive is the physical location, but also limited compensation for those positions. We may be requesting use of vacancy savings to assure our ability to hire folks who are capable and competent to move that economic development agenda forward. But again, that we would be coming back to you with. We're not asking on that today.
Maybe they heard who the new director was.
Pardon me? What was that? Something about a new director, so I'm very interested in that. Also recognizing that the substantial reduction in our service and supplies budget for 2003-05 For instance, the discretionary part of our S&S budget, those over which we have control, that was reduced about 63%. For the biennium, our travel budget was reduced by 56%, even as we are trying to make the commission more visible and particularly make me more visible out in the state, both to meet with citizens but also learn from them what the issues are regarding the department and the land use system. Difficult to do. That may bring us back also to the special purpose appropriation over and above agency vacancy savings. So again, that I just wanted to put those as markers for future consideration, but for the purpose of today's recommendation, we are in concurrence with staff recommendation and ask your favorable action. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just kind of a general question on some of the material before us. Do you have the document nature of request in front of you, a three-page document? That
yes.
It came from them. So.
The first one, I'm just curious, under the under sincerely, and then it has your name typed, Lane Shetterly.
Yes.
I can understand the Lane, but what's the second thing that's scribbled there?
Representative Miller, if you had my last name after 48 years, it might start to look like that, too.
Very good. Actually, a question regarding on the yellow sheet, just the work plan developed by DLCD in response to concerns raised by the subcommittee, just the feel for how you're reacting to some of these requirements, and that would be changing the agency's regulatory culture. Can you tell me what do you envision?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Miller. Actually, I think that was something that really got started in earnest under Nan Evans, who was acting director before me. And that has been a clear directive to staff that the department's role is one of being an active partner with local governments, assisting local governments to accomplish what they want to do, usually on behalf of their property owners and constituents themselves. To the point that I think the mantra in the department is emphasizing how to get to yes. That's what it boils down to. So that if the, for instance, a local government request comes in and it may not be technically sufficient under some particular rule or policy, if there is some alternative way to assist the department getting the local government getting what it wants, then the answer from the department on our staff level, the instruction is then that what we tell them is you can't get it this way, but there's another way to get there and assist them through this alternative process. And then, frankly, if sometimes the answer is no, if it would be a nuclear reactor next to a middle school, the answer needs to be given up front and early before somebody wastes a lot of time and money and effort in trying to achieve that. So that is the culture. It's been very much customer service orientation direction on my part, carrying through, again, what Acting Director Evans started, in making sure that we recognize our role as to assist rather than to hinder and to carry that through right out to the staff out in the field. And frankly, I've heard in my travels so far some very good feedback from local governments on who have been dealing with our staff people out there about the help that they've been to them.
That would be a wonderful change,
yeah,
I think.
It's very important.
I applaud that. Just one other thing so that I can kind of have a feel of how the new director sees the world. What was your view of Measure 7 when it was proposed, passed, and then the court, for whatever reason, tossed it?
Well, Measure 7, I think, would have ended our land use system as we know it today. Primarily through the compensation requirement, which would have really resulted in most local governments opting out on account of inability to pay the compensation at the level that would have been required by Measure 7. If you're asking me did I support or oppose Measure 7, I opposed it. As you know, Representative Williams and then-Representative Schrader spent most of the 2001 session working with the interested parties in that, trying to come up with some sort of a response, legislative response, to Measure 7, And being a next-door neighbor to Representative Williams and cohort with him, I was involved in some of those discussions on a fairly intensive basis. And they came close. They didn't get there. But if you're asking on my position on 7, that's certainly where I was, and that's on the record. So.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Metzler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to respond a little bit, too, to the questions that Representative Miller asked. As chairman of the Ways and Means Subcommittee during the last session, some of the things we were looking at was exactly as you stated, what kind of service are we getting, how long does it take, and not how long does it take for the ones that go through quite easily, but for those that don't make it through, it takes a tremendous amount of time, what's going wrong, and how do we clarify it so people really clearly understand what are the requirements up front as opposed to finding out the more and more requirements and they go through. And as I've spoken with you, Director Chatterley, just recently, I would hope that you, and I'd like you to respond on the record, that you actually take the agency back through the laws, and what is your exact authority, and are you operating within the authority? Is it from what the intentions of LCDC were in the department in the beginning, and how has it changed from that point, and are you really providing the services within your authority? So it's my feeling that the State Department ought to be guidelines, and really it ought to be the owner, the decisions made at the local level ought to be owned at the local level, whether it's a mistake or whether it's a positive, but they own that decision. And we've kind of got ourselves in a box where people are relying on the state to tell them what they should be doing and how they should be going about it. I think the goals are fine, the guidelines are fine, but that's how they should be looked at. And I'm sure there's, in law, specific areas where you do have authority. One of them I think you should and do have is in the process. Is the public process followed as people go through the land use decisions? But could you respond to that, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Senator Messerly. One of the things that I think John Chandler described it yesterday in the House Interim Land Use Review Committee as the most important bill that didn't get passed last session was House Bill 2912, I believe it was, which would have been the legislative-directed comprehensive review of the land use planning system. We are very much supportive of an effort to revive that for the coming session. I think that's getting it at just about every issue that you talked about. I will tell you that the kind of top-down review that you are suggesting is, number one, needed, and also will be very complex, because over 30 years you have had this. It began with a very, I think, at least by today's standards, a very simple and straightforward system that over time has layered statutory changes as well as administrative rule changes and policy changes and simply changes in practice to the point that we do have a system that's very different than what we started off with. Again, that didn't happen overnight, and I think it's not going to be an effort of a month or two to look at that and evaluate how those changes occurred and how to layer back some of those. But to the extent that a full and public intensive comprehensive review of the land use planning system will get at those points and reevaluate the principles on which the land use planning system was based and where we are today, we're very supportive of that. And I would expect to be a full player in that. Frankly, that's a little bit of a scary proposition, I think, for partisans on both sides, because once you start asking those questions, if you're going to deal honestly with the answers, it may take you in directions that one side or the other, or both, to some extent, may not want to go. But I think in terms of being honest in public policy, it's time we do that, because I think we've not had that kind of comprehensive review of the land use planning system. It has been a piecemeal thing. The legislature has imposed new requirements. Some of them have, again, come up through administrative rule, but it's all been on a piecemeal basis, typically responding to the issue of the day or the last problem that showed where we needed to make a fix through statute or administrative rule. And we know over time those changes affect some inconsistencies in policy, and it takes us in different directions that frustrate, I think, the fundamental framework of what's really behind land use planning. So I think your question is really an invitation to that comprehensive and top-down review And that's not something we're going to get between now and the next biennium, but I'll tell you, we will be in here in the next session as full participants with the legislature to begin the process of making that happen. I think that's critical.
Sure can. Follow up.
Certainly.
I just want to say that to the point of what we're here for today, that I think the department has made great progress, and I want to commend Nan Evans for the work she's done during session. I think you've made great progress, and you've got a lot of work yet to do, but I've seen a lot of movement. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Senator Midgley. I appreciate those comments, and I think Ms. Evans does deserve all the lion's share of the credit. But I will say, though, too, to the department's credit, these are folks, I think, who were ready to respond to some fresh leadership and a change in direction. And I think across the spectrum have largely been very receptive to this new direction. And I'm not getting substantial resistance. I think folks are willing to move, wanting some direction, and I think there's been a lack of that over the succession of some rough patch before Ms. Evans came on board the leadership of the department. But she set a course that I think the department is ready to follow, and I'm sure committed to continuing in that direction.
I would echo Senator Mesrilli's comments. I served on that subcommittee, and it was a struggle. But it was well worth it.
Yeah, I agree.
The agency has come a long way. Other questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Director Shetterly, you mentioned that relative to Measure 7, that had it passed, counties would have opted out, of the land use planning. Is that a how viable of an opportunity is that? I want to explore that just a little bit.
Well, you know, let me get my attorney general. As I recall, Measure 7, I think, presented, it was a constitutional amendment without a lot of meat on those bones, but as I recall, the analysis that came out of the Department of Justice on what that meant, and I can't recall whether it was an analysis of the text of the measure or whether it was just an analysis of the impact, was to the extent that counties and cities, local governments, were not able to provide compensation, they also then were not able to mandate compliance with their local planning ordinances. And so it really put them in that place of not being able to require compliance with local zoning and planning laws if they were not able to provide compensation. And so to the extent the compensation was not available, then it left them no choice, I think, but to basically opt out of enforcement. That did leave them between a rock and a hard place because those laws were still on the books. And so I think the issue under Measure 7 then was, did it leave the counties or cities still subject to some action by some other party, a mandamus or some other action to force compliance? But that was just one of those imponderables that we never got to in the implementation of Measure 7. But that certainly was a risk anyway, I think, identified by the Department of Justice analysis.
Follow up, Madam Chair, if I may. I just mentioned this, Director Shirley, that having been involved kind of in the periphery of a county that submitted its plan and worked on its plan for the DLCD 30 years ago, having submitted its plan, was one of the last plans in the state to be approved, which basically was a state-written plan. Everything that we put in locally was gutted and removed substantially out of the plan. And eventually we were a county which was losing all of its tobacco and all of its alcohol monies, which were frozen in escrow at the state, before finally, you can either be shot with a blindfold on or you can be shot with a blindfold off. Is how we felt, and again, I was in the periphery of that decision. So I'm anxious that we have an opportunity now, after all these years, to come back and take a look at these things. And I commend you for the efforts that you're doing to get the yes to change the culture. Thank you very much.
Blindfold off, though, would be amazing.
Okay.
Look him in the eye, buddy.
Spoken by the Colonel.
Any other questions?
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I just hate being first.
It's your pleasure.
Eyes burst out.
Well, yeah. I have a question. Are you just ready to move, or do we need to hear more discussion? Or?
Madam Chair, I need to make one clarification for the record. You'll see in the analysis from LFO that it recommends that in lieu of an allocation for the operations program, that there be a request to DAS to reschedule the vacancy savings of up to $137,806, which is the amount of the first half of the special purpose appropriation for operations, are actually three separate special purpose appropriations established, one for grants, one for landowner notification, and one for operations. And in working with DAS and the agency, it's come to LFO's attention that actually at this time, no vacancy savings have been unscheduled. So you can ignore that part of the recommendation, just with the understanding that the agency would be utilizing their vacancy savings. However, you may want to also request that DAS not unschedule whatever vacancy savings there are, to be clear that you want the agency to utilize the vacancy savings, just in case you don't want to be silent on that issue.
What's the total in vacancy savings to date?
And working with the agency and looking at their personal services expenditures to date, it looks like they have about $136,000 in vacancy savings. So it's just about the amount of the special purpose appropriation. BAM and LFO and the agency are still going to work together to refine that number, as well as projections for personal services for the rest of the biennium, and also projections in their other categories like services and supplies and capital outlay. And we'll have more information, updated information, for you when the agency returns to the emergency board.
Those have been scheduled at this point, about $136,000 savings.
I'm sorry, Representative
None
Butler.
Of those have been scheduled by DAS.
None of those have been unscheduled through the allotment system, so they're still available to the agency. The expectation was that the agency would be reporting vacancy savings to DAS at some point, and those would be unscheduled, all as a part of the administrative savings process under House Bill 2148. But that unscheduling has not occurred yet, so those savings are still available to the agency to use in lieu of allocation of this first half of the special purpose appropriation for operations.
And Madam Chair, if I may, Sue was right. We're in conversation with BAM and DAS and LFO about that. That's just an ongoing.
So are you suggesting that one of our options would be to allocate the $43,377 for the grants program?
Correct.
The $6,317 for the landowner notification?
Correct.
And then
you can request DAS to not unschedule any vacancy savings, or you could just remain silent on that issue.
Remain silent, with the, that'll get it done.
Yeah, and then I also point out that part of the recommendation has been to also acknowledge receipt of the two reports, both the progress on the work plan and then their grants allocation plan.
Senator Harper, did I hear a motion coming?
That's a motion.
Yeah, let's just don't bring it up.
Okay.
And you guys work it out. Right?
That's very good. Okay.
Sue, do you want to run through that one more time, and we'll make sure that we've got it on the record?
I said the veteran is out yet.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the recommendation is to allocate $43,377 from the special purpose appropriation for the grants program, allocate $6,317 from the special purpose appropriation for the landowner notification program, and acknowledge receipt of the two reports.
And progress?
That would be the two reports. Both the. Yeah.
Okay. Is there any discussion? No, hearing none. Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you again, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Your committee.
Pleasure.
Senator Harper, would you like to carry that?
I'd be delighted.
Great. Okay. We'll start with 19 and work our way into 20.
Wayne, do you have enough people to give you a hand here?
Should we say at least that the vacancy savings didn't come from the admin end?
Yeah. You probably make that fair.
Good morning.
Hello.
Go right ahead. This is the report on the Elliott State Forest.
Okay. You want me to start?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Spooks and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Hannis. I'm the director of the Department of State Lands.
Morning, Chair Stooks, Harper, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown, director of the Department of Forestry.
We're here in response to two budget notes relating to the management of the Elliott State Forest, as well as a budget note dealing with a cost-benefit analysis of the Elliott State Forest as well. For the Department of State Lands, this also relates to a couple items that were in the work plans that we submitted to the Ways and Means Committee. What I'd like to do is to bring forward staff from the Department of State Lands and also the Department of Forestry, who will provide you with more information in detail and to be able to answer your questions on the budget notes before you and the report. So I'd like to ask John Lilly, who's the Assistant Director of Policy and Planning, to come on up.
And ask Steve Thomas, our Assistant State Forester, for assisting.
We're going to allow them to have some space up here and sit right behind them.
Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. It's good to be here with you this morning. The Elliott State Forest is a very important asset of the Common School Fund. The majority of the acres within the 90,000-plus acre forest are Common School forest lands and are managed by a contract from the department and the land board with the Department of Forestry doing the on-the-ground management. The land board and its asset management plan adopted prescriptions for management of common school forest lands, and in particular the overarching management principle is even flow sustained yield. I believe that from an investment portfolio standpoint, the board and past boards have looked at the Elliott and its forest lands as a revenue production forest operation looking towards an amount of money, revenue flowing from the sale of timber continually over a long period of time. And as our management plans have been put together in the past and the current management plan on the Elliott point out, our goal has been to provide an even flow of timber on a sustained yield basis, meeting all the regulatory and environmental requirements that are imposed on forest land owners. One of the challenges, no doubt, on the Elliott over the years has been, the recent years, has been much the same as all private and public landowners face, and that is compliance with the federal endangered species law. And to that end, the board in 1994 took a bold step and achieved a habitat conservation plan, which sought to meet one of those basic goals of sustained yield, even flow of timber, by assuring some certainty over time in an uncertain situation. Where we currently are is revisiting that habitat conservation plan and the overall forest management plan in hopes that the learning that has happened over the last 10 years and the new information about these species and, of course, the information about additional species that have been listed since that time could all be incorporated and help to inform a revised HCP, if possible, certainly a revised management plan, so that we could possibly increase the yield of timber from the forest, increase the even flow to a higher level, and therefore increase the dollars flowing to the Common School Fund principal. Steve Thomas is from the Department of Forestry and can cover some of the details of that planning effort right now. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I'll just give you a quick overview and hit some of the highlights of where we are with the Forest Management Plan and the Habitat Conservation Plan process. It's quite a detailed report in your material, but I'll try to hit some of the highlights for you and then be happy to answer any questions you might have. John's kind of covered basically where we started in 1995 with Habitat Conservation Plan. It's interesting to note that a couple years prior to that, the harvest on the Elliott was down to around 7 or 8 million board feet, primarily because of the issues we had with northern spotted owls and marbled murrelets. once we got that plan and habitat conservation plan in process, our harvest has been about 27 million board feet off the forest. Now, that's considerably less than pre-owls and marbled merlets, but it was a substantial increase without a habitat conservation plan. As John mentioned, over the last 10 years, we've gained some new insights, but also the environment we worked in has changed. For instance, the marbled merlet habitat conservation plan or incidental take permit was only for a six-year period. That was all we could get because of the people didn't feel comfortable about the science about that particular species. So that has expired, and now we're basically, we have the owl HCP in process, but we don't have anything for merlets, and we're doing take avoidance. That's resulted in about 25% of our proposed sales we're finding merlets on. So that's putting a continuing squeeze on the operability on the Elliott. So at this point, along with the fact that we've got some new ideas and new science, we've gained 10 years of experience, we began a new planning process. We're quite a ways along now. We're exploring a range of alternatives, which the land board will be able to review. We're looking at, of course, the existing plan and what it does for you. We're looking at a wood emphasis plan, if we were to more or less turn it into an industrial model, and as John talks about later on, we'll talk about the cost-benefit analysis, and that could play into that, you know, do you sell or do you keep the Elliott, and pros and cons of that. But in between, we're also looking at some integrated plans that would, we think, achieve a respectable amount of volume, yet also allow the land board to provide some other values down there in terms of dealing with endangered species. So at this point, we have just begun the modeling process on those. We're starting to get what I think are some positive results back from the modeling process. They are showing that some of the alternatives we're looking at would show an increase in harvest over what we are currently at the 27 million, somewhere up around 40 million or so. Those all need to be fine-tuned and ground truth, but it's promising at this point in time. We are continuing to explore, and I might mention some of these alternatives are with HCP and without HCP. So we are looking at the kind of, you might say, the cost or the benefits that are derived from going with or without a habitat conservation plan. We're trying to incorporate some of the information that we have learned from our most recent events on the Northwest Forest in this new planning effort, so we're trying to learn an iterative process as we go along. The time plan, or the time frame we're operating under right now is we basically, some significant events that are occurring. We just had our first peer review of the strategies by the scientific community. We're currently reviewing those, that input, and revising our strategies as appropriate. We're getting ready to go to the land board next week and kind of bring them up to speed. Then in June, we'll be going back for public comments. We're having some meetings down in Eugene, Coos Bay, and I believe in Salem. We're going to have meetings and outline where we are at that point in time with the public. We'll also be planning towards the end of the summer a second scientific review of the strategies, and then coming back to the land board and more public comment periods later on in the year. Our hope is we can try to bring this process to a focus by the end of this year, and, you know, kind of know which direction we're going to be going. And, of course, that will be in time for a visit with the legislature for the next session. The Habitat Conservation Plan, we are looking at as an opportunity, and so we want to keep things moving along. Like, as you well know, that's a very lengthy time process, so we want to keep all our options open, so we are planning for that and seeing what it would take to get a Habitat Conservation Plan at the same time we're doing the Forest Management Plan revision and seeing how those strategies fit together. Some of the key issues that the land board will be considering, of course, is, you know, a habitat conservation plan is a business decision. What are the costs and benefits of it? Do we want sustainable, even flow off of that property, or are we willing to deviate from that? Watershed issues, you know, different scenarios down there. What do we need to do to maintain our license to operate in that particular area? As you know, that's very steep terrain down there, very rugged terrain. So we have to keep that. And also, you know, public trust and confidence, and then that we're managing public lands appropriately. So those are all things I'm sure the board will be considering. But that's kind of an overview right now of where we are and the major activities that have been going. And I would say the progress is moving along nicely. We get to a point in the planning process where you're kind of frustrated because there's all these pieces and they're not starting to come together. But over the last several months, everything's starting to come together, and we're at least getting able to focus on trying to pull these various alternatives together and begin to do some modeling. So unless John has something to add, that's kind of where we are with the forest management plan and habitat conservation plan.
Senator Messonway.
During the last session in the budget process, we heard from the department that the HCP was the right way to go, and yet we heard from the industry that very strongly that it was not the right way to go. And I guess I'm still confused to some degree, and I don't want a lengthy response, but could you basically outline why it's the proper thing to do for a public forest and not the right thing to do for an industrial forest?
You want to take a shot?
Sure. I think that, Madam Chair, Co-Chair, Senator Meserle, an HCP is a tool. A tool to be employed based upon what the overall goals of the land manager are. I think that it's not a tool that's solely appropriate for non-federal public lands or private lands. I think that each landowner needs to look at their circumstance and determine what their overarching goals are and what their impediments to reaching those goals are. And in some cases, as was the case with our situation on the Elliott in the early 90s, pursuing the habitat conservation plan for owls and murrelets was the right business decision at that time. The current board has sent us on a trajectory to continue to explore an HCP. We have one in hand. We don't want to let it go now unless we're absolutely sure that it's the right thing to do is to let it go. But we want to be prudent in addressing whether or not it's a right business decision to expand the current HCP to other species. But we have to kind of go walk that trail in order to determine that we have to know more about the conditions on the forest and what an HCP might look like in order to know if it's the right decision. So that's what we're exploring now. Now, clearly, the boards and the departments have been on a pathway and talking like, well, we will get an HCP. But I think ultimately the land board has to make that decision in a business environment based upon what they want their goals and outputs to be and how much risk they're willing to accept, given that while these are trust lands, these are public lands, and they carry a higher level of public scrutiny than would some private forest lands.
Absolutely.
As I recall some of the testimony, when we tried to sort this out in our committee, was that if you have an HCP and you have a new listing, how much good does the HCP do you? And I think the response, as I recall, was very little, that you still have to go through the whole process of the new listing and incorporate that into your HCP. On the flip side of that, if you have a delisting that's included, of a species that's included in the HCP, you still have to go through the process, the full process again, to get that species taken out of the HCP. So, and I think that's what really confused our committee as to, well, then what's the benefit? And again, you know, as my first question was, why does the industrial forest, I think, as I understand your answer, John, because you're dealing with two different types of properties and you're held to a higher level, but, you know, the industrial forest, most of them, if not all of them, have very high expectations and policies in regard to public usage and the habitat and water quality and those kind of things as well. So I think this, and as I talked to you, Steve, on the phone, this is an area that I think the industry and the department has to really sort this out so that we have a clear understanding of what are the benefits and are they perceived benefits or are they real benefits. And the bottom line is, how do we generate funds for the Common School Fund? And there will be other values we can do that as they do in the industrial forest. There's other values to the forest too, but as I read the law, the prime focus of the Elliott State Forest and the Northwest Forest too, for that matter, is to generate funding for local government and the schools. So my concern is that we don't get sidetracked off to the side and lose value.
I would say, Senator Mesley, that's what we're trying to do. I might say that even the HCP process that we're working on for the North Coast, the Western Oregon HCP, and other state forests, we're engaged with the counties, and we've got this series of like 21 questions we've came up with that we feel we need answers to be able to move forward at varying steps. I would say that the key in terms of the issues you mentioned about delisting and listing really is the implementing agreement. And when we benchmarked with both private industry and with public entities that got HCPs in 2000, we tried to implement all the lessons learned that they had into our process. Now, there are private companies that have HCPs, but again, it gets back to kind of what's the goal of that organization and how does an HCP affect the value of their property. And if they saw it as a positive, you know, reevaluation of their property, then they proceeded with it. If it wasn't, then they didn't. But some of them almost went to the point of, you know, sign or not sign before they were able to make that decision because of the negotiation process that took place between the services and the companies. So we are very aware of those issues, and we are trying to build those into our analysis and working with the Attorney General's office to develop a meaningful implementation agreement and also to learn from the other folks that have been through this process. But certainly the environment has changed with the habitat conservation plans within the last couple of years, and we're aware of that, and we'll just keep working with folks. I appreciate your comments. We'll just keep that focus on that.
Representative Miller.
With respect to the protections afforded some of the species, my recollection was, and maybe it still is, that when you had an owl's nest, you had to have a 70-acre circle around that nest where you just couldn't do anything. Is that still the case?
Representative Miller, and members of the committee, the Forest Practices Act is a 70-acre core to protect the nesting site.
What is the protection afforded the murrelet?
There are no standards in the Forest Practices Act for marbled murrelets, and the standards basically would be whatever the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and parties would feel are necessary to avoid take, and the landowners have to visit with them to do that. But there are no standards in the Forest Practices Act for marbled murrelets.
Do you think that the 70-acre circle is sufficient to protect, going back to the spotted owl?
I believe people believe that it's sufficient to protect the nesting site. The 70-acre core is designed to protect the nesting site. It's not designed for roosting, foraging, and other considerations that the owl needs for to be viable. But it does protect the nest site.
You believe the 70-acre circle is sufficient to protect the nest site?
That's what we have in the Forest Practices Act, yes.
I understand that. And my question was, do you believe that is sufficient?
Not to meet the goals on state forest lands, no. Our goals on state forest lands are different than the Forest Practices Act. So if you look at the administrative rule to protect and maintain native species, 70-acre core areas would be insufficient to do that.
That's not what I'd hoped you'd say. Well, let me ask you this. With respect to the Endangered Species Act, do you think that that act as it is in law today is appropriate, or do you think there ought to be some change? And do you advocate the change if you believe there ought to be some?
I assume, Representative, you're asking for my opinion. Or you want agency opinion?
I think we respect you guys as being out in the forest and understanding the situation probably better than those who make law.
I will give you my experience working with the Endangered Species Act from the state forest perspective. And that is, It it's a very difficult process to deal with for landowners, whether you're private or public. And it's a very complicated process. It takes a lot of resources. But the bottom line, I guess, is from our standpoint, with our goals and objectives, a habitat conservation plan, if we can get through the process, is kind of like buying an insurance policy. And how much do you want to pay for the premium, and what are you getting for the premium that you're paying? And so there is a process outlined there, but I would tell you right now it's a very difficult, lengthy, timely process to go through and requires a great deal of resources, and that was basically solidified when we visited with all the companies, the private companies. But again, it's kind of buying an insurance policy. Could the Endangered Species Act be rewritten and be better? I'm sure it could be, but we're dealing with what we have right now, and I know from private owner standpoint they have difficulty under dealing with those issues, and small woodland owners have difficulties dealing with those issues, and maybe even more so than large industrial folks. But again, if you adjust your objectives, you can eliminate habitat. And if you have 40 and 45-year rotations, then in essence you don't have habitat for northern spotted owls and marbled murrelets. Therefore, you don't have to worry too much about the Endangered Species Act. So, you have those objectives.
Part of the purpose of my question is that many times I think we have agencies who kind of sit back and take it from policymakers, be it here or Washington. And I've begged for years, I guess, for those of you who are on the ground to tell people in here or in Congress that, maybe somebody who lives in concrete all the time told you this would be a fabulous idea to protect species, but it's either not needed nor it just doesn't work out here where you're trying to apply it. And so I plead with those who have knowledge to implement it. The other thing I wanted to ask about the sustained yield even flow, is your policy to practice the harvest levels at a particular amount every year, irrespective of market condition? Or do you do what a lot of folks do when the market's hot, maybe you harvest a little more, and when it's not, you kind of put your saws aside?
Representative Miller, members of the committee, our strategy has been sustained even flow. That does fluctuate each year, and if you look at it for a variety of reasons, we do like to take advantage of markets. It's a difficult thing to do with when you've got a public planning process you have to go through. In other words, we're start planning 1 to 2 years in advance for our sales. For this particular 04, we started a couple years ago planning for those sales. So the markets change. It's somewhat difficult to take advantage of those, but we do try to because we have alternate sales and things like that we could put up that are just kind of sitting on the shelf. So we do try to take advantage of that. But the goal has been a sustained even flow over time. And that has been kind of trying over time that results in an even flow into the fund. And so that has been the approach we've taken.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Miller, I will say that this issue of market timing, if you want to call it that, in terms of watching the current price and trying to maybe put more timber on the market when the price is higher, that's an issue that we've been discussing at the steering committee level as we've been proceeding with this management plan, and it's a highlighted issue. So. We're not unaware of its possible advantages, and we want to analyze that.
Thank you.
Other questions, Senator Messer?
If I could come back.
Sure.
Representative Miller just brought up another point that I'd like to expand a little bit. Mr. Thomas, what I heard you say was that the policies that you have as a state forest, the LA State Forest, are more stringent than what the Forest Practices Act. So that gets back to the cost of operation or the ability to generate income off of forest, and speaks very to the point of what we were getting at with the budget note. Is it
better for the Common School Fund to sell the forest and put that money in trust, and could they generate more harvest? Could you identify better how those policies differ between the state policy of management of the forest and the Forest Practices Act, and what that means to harvest levels?
Well, I think we will be able to do that clearer. I mean, we've got the preliminary modeling done, so I could give you some numbers now, but then, then people say, "Oh, that was an interesting number. Now, where did it go?" Once you start ground truthing it. But if you were to go to we've worked with Oregon Forest Industries Council, and they have asked us to model a particular scenario, and we're going to do that, which results in basically shorter rotations, moving away from even flow. And it really peaks the harvest out. I mean, you could be harvesting 140 million board feet a year in the first decade. The second decade, you probably dropped a half of that. The third decade, you probably wouldn't harvest much of anything on the forest because it's all growing again. Because you would basically, and what you would do is just as sites become vacant, for instance, you would harvest that. So over time, you would have a young industrial forest with a rotation age somewhere around 40 to 60 years old, somewhere in that vicinity. And that would produce for you initially a much, much higher volume. Other alternatives which wouldn't do that may produce, say, 40 million on a sustained even flow up to maybe 50 million. So 40 to 50 million over the long term. So what we are also preparing is some pros and cons for each alternative so that the board can look at that. In terms of the costs, we have been watching the costs fairly closely, and I think most people would agree public land management is more expensive than private land management. But the couple of times that we have had outside parties look at our costs, the costs seem to be reasonable for the type of management that's taking place on the forest. And that the revenue, cost revenue issue was as a measure of the market, not the costs that were going out there in terms of what we were spending on the ground. It was what were we getting for the trees. When you go from a peak of over $700 per thousand in the mid-90s to $450 a thousand now, and you're selling the same amount of volume, but you still need the same resources out there to put up the sales and monitor them and reforest them and everything else, then you're going to show a decrease in revenue to cost. And that's, in essence, what has occurred over the last few years, is the volume's still going out. The cost of maintained basically pretty flat, really, over the last 5 years or five biennium. But the market has gone down, as any of you who have owned timberland are aware. The market's not at its peak now. So we are looking at ways to increase the harvest. And as John mentioned, we look at maybe we need to depart from even flow. And I think the land board will have a full array of alternatives to look at in terms of the costs and benefits to managing that forest down there, as well as the information they'll have from the cost-benefit analysis. Is it better to sell the Elliott than it is to retain it? And I think they'll have that full array, and hopefully they'll be able to make a conscientious, a good decision based on that. Is that kind of what you were looking
for? I think so. I mean, I realize it is very complex, and there's a lot of issues that you're sorting through right now, so appreciate it.
Questions? I have a couple. John, you mentioned in regards to the Elliott, you have a HCP in hand. Are you referring to the Owl HCP?
Madam Co-Chair, absolutely. Yes, we have a currently viable Owl HCP.
And Steve, you mentioned that others have gotten HCPs. Is there a private company in the state of Oregon that's gotten an HCP?
I believe Weyerhaeuser on the Millicoma has an HCP for owls. Which would, Millicoma is adjacent to the Elliott State Forest.
And then I've been curious for some time why an HCP for owls and an HCP for murrelets, and then we'll wait and see, and what else we need, perhaps salmon or whatever. Why not an MCP?
Why not an HCP?
Why not go for multiple species in one, an MCP?
Oh, our HCP process this time is to go for a multi-species HCP.
Okay.
And what you look at there is trying to build the strategies around the major critters that you're trying to deal with, which is northern spotted owl, marbled mullet, and coho. And then, if there are species that could potentially be listed and or pertinent or relative to that particular piece of property you're looking at, we look at that. So whether it's a salamander or a frog or something like that, we try to incorporate as many species as we can so that we don't have to go back through a process. And it's relatively, we have been told, and there's documentation, it's a relatively easy process to have a species that becomes listed, you know, if it's in your plan to deal with it. You don't have to go back through the whole HCP process all over again. So we are looking at a multi-species HCP, and the breadth of that will depend on the strategies and our negotiations with the services.
But initially you're going in requesting it for three species, is that
No, right? We're going in for, I think we've multi, which is, I think, about 17 species, Ross. 17 on the LES.
Could I get a copy of, and I don't know if anybody else, maybe Senator Messler, maybe everybody would like a copy of just what all the species are that you would fold into that,
sure,
that request. I appreciate it. And Senator Messerly, where are we with the coho down your way? Aren't they on the edge of not being listed anymore? I mean, I know it's all
on
court.
On the North Coast, yeah. The entire coast is.
That's what I thought. I've not been focusing on it lately, so would that make a difference?
With the coho?
Yeah, if it were delisted, would
it
that...
It would definitely make a difference in our
would
strategies.
Would you still include it in your request?
It's possible we would include it in our request, but it it changes the negotiation strategies considerably with the services.
Not trying to say that I think you should do one thing or another, but if it were no longer on the endangered species list, why would you include it in your...
Well, I think the question begins, again, assessing risk. Is there? It's off now. Is it coming back in a year or two? And we're trying to develop a long-range plan. And so it's kind of looking at those other species like the salamanders and the pond turtles. And are they going to come back? Well, in those instances, are they going to come on the list? If those, they come on, they're so local and very specific sites that they're not a major issue. But when you get something like coho... That's a totally different picture because of the breadth of the coverage that it would take on a property. So I think we would look at it from an assessment standpoint and just say, you know, is there a possibility, what's the possibility of them being listed again? And if there's a possibility and it's not going to cost us an arm and a leg, can we get a multi-species HCP? On the other hand, if it's too expensive and we can't get successful negotiations with the services, then we may say, they're not on the list. So I think we're keeping that option open, and we're trying to keep in touch with those different analyses that are going on.
In addition to the cost of actually getting the HCP for each species that you're talking about, do you take into consideration the cost in decreased harvest? I mean,
yes.
If the coho are included, then I assume there are wider buffers along some streams, which is reduced. I mean, is that part of your cost calculation as well?
That would be part of our analysis. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Butler.
Just a couple of questions here. In the read, it indicates that the budget note calls for a strategy of keeping the forest land management costs within the range for comparable lands managed for similar outcomes. My question was, while a state rule is more comprehensive than the federal rule for the management of those endangered species, how can we even attempt to keep forest land management costs within that range for comparable as compared to private industry?
Well, Representative Butler, members of the committee, basically... The issue of comparables is very complicated, but if you wanted to go to grab a comparable, you could run up to Washington DNR and that would be a state agency managing public lands. And, you know, they're kind of going through quite a process now. But, again, that would be one comparator we could make. And we have done that. But we have compared our costs with private industry. And John Buter, Professor Buter out of Oregon State University, has done a number of economic analysis for us. And you show the cost in some instances are higher for certain things and lower for others. But down on the Elliott, because of the type of timber we've got and the age of the stands we've got down there, we fare fairly well in our operating costs for a 90,000-acre forest. That's another thing you have to be comparable to, you know, who owns 90,000 acres on the coast at public ownership, or who are you going to compare yourself to? So, but we do try to reach out and find comparables and try to see where are we in this process. You know, is there something that looks weird? We do end-of-the-year reviews, and we review costs, road costs, engineering costs, reforestation costs. And we kind of sit back and contemplate, well, where are we in terms of the industry in terms of cost? Where are we in terms of our silviculture practices? And then we make adjustments as necessary. So finding an actual comparable would be very difficult, but we do try to make that effort.
Didn't serve on the committee. I didn't author this note, but I would have been surprised if the comparable lands that they were speaking of were other state lands to other state lands. And while you may have 90,000 acres in one fell swoop in the Elliott State Forest, there should be some economies of scale that say, man, I don't want to compare costs to comparable lands. I want to just show that our costs are significantly less, significantly reduced per acre per whatever. On this land, so I wasn't there to understand why this about this budget note, but I would have thought that it would have said, you know, are we comparing ourselves with other folks that are taking sticks of lumber to market, and in this process, that was my last observation with regard to this budget request was, you know, when will all of this guarantee us at some point that we will have more lumber coming to market, more economic opportunities, and I haven't heard that. I'm looking at the timeline. It looks like some of it, particularly the NEPA process, might go on indefinitely. So I'm concerned that, you know, that we're really not getting the answers that perhaps the budget committee that examined the DSL originally was asking. But I probably shouldn't go on further from there. Thank you.
I should probably just turn it over to Senator Messerly because it's his budget note, but I will tell you, Representative Butler, that we are getting approximately the same kind of answers today that we got then.
Okay.
If that
Sorry.
Doesn't, yeah. Senator Messerly.
Just very briefly.
Your budget note.
For Representative Butler's on the committee's benefit. Where this really came from was we saw a pattern where the revenue was decreasing and over a period of time. Even after we looked at what's happened to the market, the revenue was decreasing and the cost was increasing. It's time we take a look at this. And I think the Division of State Lands, in their entirety, in their ownership, is reviewing the same thing. Are we getting a proper return, or does it make sense for us to own property? Period.
Increasing costs and decreasing revenue is no way to run a business.
There's an end to that game.
Thank you.
Representative
Bill. I'm sure you have a variety of ages of stands in the Elliott.
I'm sorry?
There's a variety of ages of the stands. What is the oldest and how many acres? Do you have old growth?
Representative Miller and members of the committee, I think I'm going to turn around and see if someone has better answers than I. We do have a little bit of old growth, what would be defined as old growth. Thank you, Ross.
For the record, I'm Ross Holloway, the Director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry. I represent Miller, Chair Dukes, and members of the committee. The Elliott actually has what we call a bimodal age distribution, where about half of the forest are the original stands following the 1868 fire that created the Elliott. So those stands are generally 130 to 140 years old. The rest of the Elliott are stands of a variety of ages that are a result of the management activity from about 1950 onward. So stands from 0 to 50 years of age out there on the forest. So it's like I said, it's bimodal with heavy acres on both ends. In terms of true old growth, I believe we have about 1,000 acres of true old growth stands that survived the 1868 fire or were acquired in parcels in trades that weren't part of the fire.
Do you anticipate harvesting any of the old growth?
The true old growth, most of it is included in conservation areas that were established in the earlier HCP for owls. So most of it is in those areas and won't be harvested anytime soon. About 200 or 300 acres is intermixed in smaller patches within some of the older stands on the Elliott, the 130 to 140-year-old stands. So whether they get harvested is going to just depend on where they are in that stand, how they're located. But they could be. Some of those acres could be harvested as part of the normal rotation or harvest acres on the Elliott.
Maybe you can help me with this definition up where I come from. Suburbs of Portland, people refer to ancient forests. Well, how old is an ancient forest, and are there any?
Representative Miller and
I think anything over about 5 years old is ancient to the people up north.
I don't really have an answer to what an ancient forest is. I can tell you that our definitions of old growth, which we take from the Society of American Foresters definitions, essentially, we look at a stand at least 175 years old that also has some of those classic characteristics of those large old trees. So that's about the best I can offer you on that question.
Thank you.
I thought it was anything over 175 to get to old growth?
Chair Dukes, that's in a lot of the definitions that are out there from Society of American Foresters and other sources, generally 175 to 200 is when stands reach that condition that classically we call old growth. But everybody has their own opinion on that.
I
just thought, say, foresters were about
100.
Okay.
Chairman,
just
a very brief one along those lines. How many years does it take till an old-growth tree is laying on the ground again? Because I can take you through a lot of my country where they're coming down. The tops are coming out, and then you see some of them laying on the ground. 400, 500 years, or what?
Senator Mesley and Chair Dukes, members of the committee, it's quite variable depending on the site and the conditions. There are probably old-growth trees in the Cascades that are 800 to 1,000 years old. I would say on the coastal strip, because of wind and other factors, generally they're going to diminish before that. Primarily through wind, so maybe 300 or 400 years old in the Coast Range.
Senator Harper.
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, this last hour has just been extraordinary. It's been illuminating. It's been educational. But how much of this is an emergency?
Well, the emergency is that we told them to bring us a report, and we have to decide now whether or not we want to accept their report.
I'm going to accept the report.
Cooper, we're gonna miss this.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All right. Is there any objection to accepting the report?
Good.
Seeing that, so ordered.
Chair, good.
Senator Messon is going to care. All right, moving right on to number 20. At this point, we're ordering in for lunch.
Courtney's going to beat us again.
Yeah, and he'll be in here shaking his finger at us. Welcome back.
Thank you. Can we start again?
Go right ahead.
Okay. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. I handed out some testimony, but I'm not, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all of it. I would like to point out this request is with regards to the South Slough National Estuary and Reserve located in Charleston, Oregon. The mission of the reserve is threefold, dealing with education, stewardship, and research. And the request before you is to increase expenditure limitations for the reserve in order to accept three grants related to the research mission of the reserve. The package of the research projects is important, and you'll see attached to my testimony are letters of support from the seafood processing industry and the oyster growers. It provides information critical to businesses and shellfish growers. Two, it adds capacity to conduct careful and objective measurements of the change in condition of estuaries with regard to the impact of human activities and natural events. And three, it provides benchmark indicators for estuary conditions. There's three parts to the request. One is federal funds, and there are two other funds grants. The federal fund grant is supplemental to the existing federal operations award granted to South SLU each year and did not require pre-authorization to apply. And the two other awards for other funds fall within the existing authority that allows the agency to apply for small and unexpected grants. We concur with the recommendations of the LFO and BAM analysts. Although it does require additional personnel, we are currently exploring options to meet those needs, including contract services, graduate students, or other limited duration positions. So once we figure out the best approach in working with LFO and BAM, then we would proceed with how we would then have staffing for that grant. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Senator Messerly.
Madam Chairman, I don't have a question, but I've been involved in the needs of this for some time and the water quality within the South Slough Sanctuary, and they've been trying to decide where the E. coli come from, and this study will give them the funding to do a DNA testing. And so I think it's very much needed, very supported by the community, both in the sanctuary as well as the private sector, the oyster growers and the food processors. So I would move that we accept this report and accept the LFO's recommendations.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could just point out one
right
thing. You'll see in the analysis that LFO is recommending that you increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $122,650. And this was made up of two of the grants. They had requested $86,650 other funds limitation for the shellfish study grant, and that actually is coming in at $82,650. At the time this analysis was written, the grant from OHSU was expected to be $40,000, and now it's $33,000. So I would recommend that the other funds expenditure limitation be increased by $115,650, and then the federal funds expenditure limitation by $42,000, and then also a recommendation that DAS be requested to unschedule the additional limitations until the Department of State Lands actually receives the funds, and they also provide updated expenditure documentation to ensure that the additional limitations still are needed at the time that they receive the funds.
And I know that's what Senator Messerly said over there.
Right.
Okay.
What I meant.
Representative Miller.
A question either for Senator Messerly or our panelists. Senator Messerly, you spoke to the need for the E. coli information. Is that covered under the first grant?
Want me to talk about?
What I'm concerned with is actually maybe just the broad coverage of number three, mm-hmm. and in particular the SWMP measures changes in estuarine waters to provide information on how human activities and natural events affect coastal resources. I'm stunned that we can do that for $50,000, but secondly, what are we talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, this, well, first of all, the first award is the one that would look at characterization and hydrodynamic distribution of bacterial contamination, and that's the one that has been done as a collaborative effort with local, state, federal agencies along with businesses. So that's, you know, one that we have a lot of support. With regard to number three, on that's one that would allow us to purchase and install transmission equipment. So it allows us to transmit from three long-term monitoring stations within the tidal areas real-time information. That's going to be important for giving us daily forecasts of tides, weather, water temperatures, water quality, storm surges, and that helps tremendously with the maritime shipping, oil spill response, aquaculture, and public safety. So it's this, by putting in place its system, between Oregon and Washington, it's really going to be the first time in the nation that we can integrate a framework for real-time measurements within the estuaries, along the shoreline, and the near ocean. So we think that it provides that kind of necessary data to be able to look at those conditions.
Is it activity what you're focusing on, or fishing boats, or what are we...
It gives you the data necessary so that you can analyze, when you have a natural event that occurs, or when you have a human caused event, such as an oil spill or contamination or whatever, as well as if you have a major storm activity, changes to your tidal influences. So it gives us a variety of information.
Okay. Thank you. Discussion on the motion? We've all heard the motion. Is there any objection? So ordered.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Senator Messerly, I assume. All right. Number 10.
Find that pretty valuable. It was great.
Was that better, Hooper?
Modestly.
Yeah, right.
If I hadn't... Yeah, okay.
You got to break yourself in slowly.
Okay, we move on to number 10, Department of Fish and Wildlife, a rebalance. Mr. Director.
Chair Dukes, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We come before you today with agenda item number 10, requesting a rebalance of the agency's 2003-2005 legislative-approved budget in compliance with the following budget note, which stated the department is directed to monitor the structure and the operation of the agency during budget execution. The agency will consult with and report to the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Budget and Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services on a budget rebalance plan if necessary. We found that to be necessary working both with Legislative Fiscal Office and the Budget and Management Office of the Department of Administrative Services. The rebalance will strengthen the agency's ability to be accountable to the public regarding the use of funding sources available. The net effect of this rebalance is no additional funds and no additional positions or FTE. It's a technical adjustment internally to the agency that we will use to account for our 03-05 budget as well as building our 05-07 budget. The major components of the rebalance are a cleanup of several years where the agency did not track its federal funds in conjunction with program and positions through the PICS process. We've accomplished that. It is also part of the consolidation that took place when the streamlining effort was undertaken to move the Habitat Division, dissolve the Habitat Division in the agency, and move it into the Fish Division and Wildlife Division during the Ways and Means process in the 03 legislative session. It does align two realty positions from admin services to Fish Division, and it does align the wildlife damage services and programs into the wildlife program. As I mentioned earlier, we will ensure that we monitor this rebalance through the 03-05 program expenditures and build on our 05-07 budget when we come before the 05 legislative session. Our goal after this rebalance is that we should be able to take care of all of our internal technical adjustments through the normal budget process. I don't anticipate needing to come back for a rebalance, and I certainly appreciate the partnership that's been exhibited and practiced by both the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Budget and Management Office of the Department of Administrative Services. We're not asking for any new expenditure limitation, and I ask that you do approve the limitation adjustments in our request of the rebalance.
Thank you. Other questions? I have one, and feel free to tell me that I'm reading the chart wrong, and that would maybe answer everything. But I'm looking at this, and it's Do I see it correctly that there's a decrease of 22 positions in fish natural production?
I've had to reproduce unnaturally.
Only in Multnomah County.
Without the help of the biologists, I don't know.
Chair Dukes, to describe exactly where positions were moved and where they went to, I would ask Chris Kautz, our deputy director, to come forward to specifically identify the position string.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Chris Kautz, Deputy Director for Administration at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. That question that you asked about those 22 positions, essentially what that is when the Habitat Division was dispersed between the Fish Division and the Wildlife Division, we didn't quite get the split right about where those positions should be distributed. And so those positions, more positions than necessary, ended up in natural production on the fish side when they really belong on the wildlife habitat side. So this shows that the program will remain the same and that those positions will continue to do what they do, but this gets them where they're actually managed and supervised out of, which is the wildlife program. You're welcome.
Questions? No other questions?
Move to approve the request.
Oh, unless he's got a
question. No question. I just want to make a comment.
Go ahead.
I just think, Madam Chair, that this is an example of how government agencies should operate. I mean, you've been very progressive. This is a follow-through of what we were doing the last two sessions. And I think it's going to pay dividends not only for the next session and their budgeting process, but in the department's budget itself. So.
Nice to see. Representative Miller.
Approve the request.
Okay.
See my motion.
Representative Miller moves that we approve the LFO recommendation. Mr. Siebert, would you like to weigh in here before we run right over you?
I believe Legislative Fiscal is recommending approval of the rebalance actions.
Yes. Okay. So we have a motion. No discussion. Any objection? So ordered.
How much money do we spend on fish natural production anyway?
Is that list?
Never mind.
In a hatchery, it's not quite as natural as you would think.
That's natural production. That's a different place. Zero is probably a fair difference. What do I know?
A carrier. Representative Miller would like to carry it. All right. Okay. That moves us on to 21. Mr. Director, well, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jeff Huntington, the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I'm here today before you with a request for permission to apply for approximately $13 million in federal funds from the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund and for an increase in my federal fund expenditure limitation of $8.3 million. I'll say right out of the bat, I concur and I'm very pleased with it. LFO recommendations, BAM recommendations, we worked hard to kind of coordinate this request. So I'll make my remarks very brief. Three points. First, this request is, in my mind, a continuation of discussions that we had at length in the legislative session as we were structuring budgets not only for OWEB's non-capital grant program, but also for accomplishing some movement in general fund and Measure 66 reductions that pertain to the Oregon Plan program. Second, the timing of the request is very important to the grant program, and I've got some critical timing needs that are driving the request to be before you in April as opposed to later on in the biennium. And third, the amount requested is less than the total grant award, not because we don't anticipate needing the total grant amount that is coming to Oregon from Congress, but because I wanted to be conservative and only come to you now with very explicit needs that were pending, and so we tried to shape this request in a way that it would be very clear on how we anticipated allocating the funds out through the grant program. The agenda item is part of what we worked on in the session because of about $20 million in federal funds that was from the same funding source that we used to help cover Oregon Plan program needs. I think in ODF, ODFW, Department of Ag and DEQ, while we covered some of those needs, what we ended up doing was putting on hold OWEB's non-capital grant program, which funds projects such as gives dollars for monitoring activities, technical assistance to landowners to develop projects, assessing watershed conditions, and moving forward with education outreach kind of activities. As a result of putting on hold the OWEB grant program in anticipation of this next installment of federal funds, we essentially partially funded May 03 grant awards that my board had in front of them. I canceled a grant cycle, and we held back doing another round of technical assistance grants. We then acted on grant applications in June of this year, 04, contingent upon the Oregon being able to receive the funding from Congress that is in this package. So we, at this point, have a timing issue, which is my second point, and that is that I've got about $2 million in grants that my board has gone through technical review. My board has said we would like to award these grants. Those monitoring activities are many of them slated to occur in the in-water work period this summer, and so we've got a bit of a timing issue. Those are all monitoring and assessment activities that will be conducted by watershed councils or soil and water conservation districts pretty much all around the state. And then I have about $1.1 million in grant applications that are pending for my board to act on in May, which are going through a review process now. We have a real need to get a technical assistance cycle started so that we can provide landowners that have project needs with the assistance to get designs and permits for their projects done, and so they can be eligible to get funding for the projects in the summer of 05. And so there's kind of a queue in that regard that is pending. And we also have, as part of where we will allocate this money, a number of groups that are trying to work to produce sub-basin plans and priorities so that they are eligible to compete for BPA funds. And they received some money but not enough money to complete that process, and we want to help them complete that process so they can be competing for those federal monies to come into their communities as well. Third, last point, again, I've worked hard to be conservative on the request. 8.3 and the limitation we request today covers some very clear program needs that we've outlined in our request, and I'll be happy to discuss the particulars of those if you want. And we worked with LFO to make sure that what was expected coming out of the legislative session is reflected in the request in front of you today, and I hope that we've done that. And with that, I'll answer any questions you have for me.
Madam Chairman, just a comment, and I hesitate to. I'm very concerned because I've been very involved in this process from my first day in session in the legislature, back in '97. And I told Director Huntington that. 2 days ago on the phone that I had reviewed it very briefly and that I had no concerns then, but I wanted to look at it more carefully. Upon further review and with some recent events and my concerns for the integrity of the department, I'm going to be a no vote on this agenda today.
If I understand correctly, this is money that's going to go out to the watershed councils, basically. I mean, there are other... You have a variety of people who apply for grants, but monitoring and assessment work is generally done by them. So,
Senator Dukes, this money will go to watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts as the primary deliverers. There is not an agency component to a different state agency or something that's built into this. The only money that is not aimed at getting out directly to the local groups and the different communities is the portion of the money that is starting up an evaluation of the effectiveness of the investments that are being made in restoration activities, and that we anticipate contracting. I hope to work with the university on that.
One of my concerns here is that a couple of years ago, we in the legislature got pretty stern with the agency, OWEP, and said, you're not moving the money out, you're not working with the local councils and NRCS, you're not doing what we told you to do. And we've had our go-rounds with the board, and I think that in the last year, year and a half, the board's paid a lot of attention and spent quite a bit of time trying to revamp their system so that they could get the money out, so that they could be responsive to the needs of the on-the-ground folks that we put in that are the basis of the Oregon plan. And now those groups have grant requests before the board, and this time, if it gets held up, it won't be the board holding it up, it will be us. And we then will be responsible to, I know I have constituents on watershed council boards and in NRCS who will likely come visit with me if this doesn't get approved. The other concern I have is that we've fought hard over the years to be included as part of that Pacific salmon money. And I figure that one of these days it's going to go away. And we know that we can't afford all of the assessment and restoration and the projects that the reports that we've seen tell us need to be done. And I'm really concerned that if this money has been approved by Congress and that we're not applying for it, the signal that we're sending to Washington, D.C. is we don't need to do this work. And if we don't need to do the work, then the entire Oregon plan is in jeopardy because we don't need the watershed councils, we don't need the strong relationship we have with NRCS, we don't need any of that if indeed we don't need to do the work. And then I think we're going to figure out that we do need to do the work, and that as particularly as part of the Endangered Species Act, but that's how we've held off some of the listings, and that we do need to do it, and if the money's gone, then we're going to have to come up with it on our own. Senator Harper.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I talked to Jeff the other day on the telephone. I was of the understanding we were going to have a confirmation hearing yesterday and a vote today for confirmation vote. That's been delayed for some reason or another.
The Rules Committee decided not to.
And I would like to hold this in abeyance until we have a confirmation hearing and a vote. That's really my issue. I guess my question to you, Paul, is if this thing slips till June, what are the impacts? Where are we?
The problem we have, Senator, is Senator Messerly mentioned that to me. That's part of why I was delayed this morning. Mm-hmm. I went down and checked with the Senate President about pulling it off the agenda, and he refused to do that.
Okay, can we...
So we have to put it out of subcommittee.
Uh-huh.
How we put it out is up to us, but we have to put it out, send it back to the full committee. It's different than session.
And... Madam Chair, Senator Harper, as to your question of whether the consequences of not approving this at this point, I think that if I were to make a recommendation, I think that you should at least go forward with approving the application for the money. The money's sitting there waiting for us. The federal agency has been asking when we're going to get the money. If you were to defer on the limitation,
okay,
I think the director has discussed the consequences of that. So they've already gone through one grant cycle of one of these types of funding, I believe, for the monitoring and assessment. They have another one for the education coming up. And all that work that has been approved has been on hold pending the release of these dollars or the authority for the department to spend these dollars.
And I would like to do that as soon as we get a confirmation hearing. But the grant request that, we wouldn't be sending a signal outside the state that we don't care about this if we did that.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd make a motion that we do that, that we go ahead and approve the federal grant application to the National Marine Fisheries Service, but without expenditure limitation of any of the $13.133 million grant application.
Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one question I have, and maybe that's better directed at Jeff, is there was a earmark in the $1.33 million like a $1.1 million earmark by Congress that said that some of those monies were going to be spent on mass fish marking trailers. I'm not sure, is the agency, would they be seeing that money, or would NIMS be taking care of those, that the expenditure of those dollars?
Madam Co-Chair, Paul, the earmark from Congress, the way it's set up, will be subtracted out of Oregon's share before the grant agreement is written with OWIP. The dollars that I'm requesting federal fund limitations for are dollars that will go on the ground in every county in the state with local groups, soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, city, local municipal governments in some cases that are partnering, extension service that is partnering to accomplish monitoring and collection of data that we use, all of us in the state, to accomplish the Oregon Plan objectives and to provide grants to landowners so they can begin to go through a permitting process and a design process in order to accomplish restoration activities on their lands, and to local groups so they can compete to get BPA money. And if we fail to complete these sub-basin plans, then in the Columbia Basin, the Bonneville Power Administration, the Northwest Power Planning Council, has set in place a process that an inadequate plan means that those communities can no longer submit grants for Power Planning Council funds to come to the state. And some of the money that is attached to this request is to help for that. It is not money to run my agency, and it is not money that is going to go to operate state agency affairs. This is money that would pass through to local groups. The Lower Columbia Subbasin Plan. To my knowledge, Senator Dukes, none of the subbasin plans have been accepted, gone through the review process of the independent science team of the Power Planning Council, come out and been revamped and officially accepted. I believe some have been submitted and some have received some comments. I don't know about the Lower Columbia plan.
I don't, not interested in jeopardizing a whole section of my district.
Well, let's get this thing fixed. Confirmation
we don't
behind us. Let's get
going. Meet for another 2 months, and we can't. I don't know how to fix that. That committee is not scheduled to meet. I'm assuming your leadership and my leadership
I'll
made a
back.
Decision.
I'll come back,
Senator. I'm assuming your leadership and my leadership made a decision yesterday. Is that not how it went? Not to move it forward. The Rules Committee made the and with. Both caucus chair people sitting there made the decision not to move forward on some of the appointments. This was one of them.
The chair did.
Okay.
The chair did.
Okay, got that. Little backing probably from the middle of the building. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make it clarify my statement a little bit. I would support the motion that's on the table. But we had a commitment from the last confirmation session from the governor's office. We thought this was going to move ahead. I've had conversations with the governor and his staff about my concerns within the department and the leadership in the department. And I just think that we need to send a very strong message. And I personally do not accept the blame that these are not going down. It was very clear of what was to be expected in this session today. And as my colleague here stated, your leadership pulled away from that. And I think it's just time that we clarify this once and for all. A commitment is a commitment, and that's how this building operates. If those commitments are broken, I think we need to sit down and have a very frank talk about what's going on and how is this government being operated.
Senator, I'm going to say those same words on another issue could come before us later this morning, so I can appreciate where you're coming from. And I guess what I need to try to sort out for myself is we're going to apply for the money and we'll get it. And then what are we doing any damage to the BPA funding and the rest of that if you have to hold off for 2 months to act? I mean, I understand we're going to miss a grant cycle and and those take a while to set up. I mean, I'm looking to support the motion, but I want it very clear that I would like the entire recommendation. I can't go home and explain to my folks that just because you know, there may have been some disagreement with what happened in another committee that we chose not to give them money to be able to respond in the season that they've got to do assessments and plant trees, because assessment and monitoring, I've always believed, is what made the Oregon plan. Without that, we were just out there planting trees and hoping for the best. And I need to understand that my select area fishery is not in jeopardy as a result of this.
Senator Dukes, I honestly can't tell you what the criticality of the timing is to have the state supplement the money that was given to sub-basin planning in different parts. I know that some of the plans are due within the next 60 days, but it's a budget issue with respect to each one of those groups as to whether or not what they're submitting, they had enough money to complete it, or they were going to submit it for comment knowing it was inadequate but relying on us to help swing around behind and complete it so it would be adequate in time for the grant cycles. I am not sitting here today with the information to tell you that waiting until June is going to jeopardize one group or another in the sub-basin planning process. I just don't know. I know that the deadline is this spring, and it's all in flux in terms of trying to queue up and have plans accepted by the Power Planning Council in time to be eligible to apply for the next revolving cycle of grant applications that the Power Planning Council is running, which right now is running in revolving cycles of every 3 years or so. And I just don't know where it sits. I know that we've had a real expression of need.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the reason for my motion is that I can see that we've got an impasse, and rather than to draw through the political process in a ways and means issue here, the issue is to attempt to do the least amount of damage, and we can follow a Hippocratic oath here, by applying for or authorizing the application of the funds if we lose a portion of the cycle of the folks that may need some of these funds out in the field, we will still have made the application or still have authorized the application for the grant. And I'm sorry that we've lost some time, but it appears that there's some political reason why the chair of the committee in the Senate side has pulled names off of confirmation hearings. I'd like to see that process go forward. But that notwithstanding, I think that it's important that we move forward and make the application of the grant. If we are held up a little bit, then we do have the grant application in process. The funds are coming.
I appreciate that, Representative Butler, and that's why I'm going to support the motion. My big concern, and Jeff, I hope you can help us get some information before full committee tomorrow. My concern is that there are groups that are partway through on what it takes to get a BPA funding, and that in the case of my group, which I'm starting to suspect is not in jeopardy here, but I don't know that, it's the difference as to whether or not they end up getting the eggs and getting to move forward with them and produce the fish that will return in 3 years and provide thousands and thousands of dollars to the local economy. And that's huge to the largest city in my district, which isn't all that big. So maybe we can move forward here and we can get more information before we're going to full committee tomorrow. And Senator Harper, you can have the discussions that you're hoping to have. Okay? Certainly, Representative Miller.
Question of our resident expert.
Mm-hmm.
You said this motion needs to proceed to the full committee, whether it's voted on by a majority of the members or not. And it proceeds.
Representative Miller, the item moves to full. It either moves without recommendation, with some recommendation.
Even if it's defeated, or if there's a vote that says it's 4-1 in opposition,
right,
it still moves.
It would move forward with a recommendation to not approve the request.
Wouldn't that have to be a motion?
We have an amended motion that we're going to vote on.
And that means everything in front of us today is moving, whether we like it or not, and there's no opportunity, say, to table the motion.
And the the emergency board rules, there is no provision for a subcommittee to hold on to an item. All items must be forwarded to the full committee.
Okay. Let's go.
Okay. Any other discussion?
So the motion is, Tom's motion?
The motion is to approve the submission of the grant for $13.133 million. And blank after that, no increase in federal funds expenditure limitation. We just make the application.
Is there any objection? Representative Miller is noted as an objection. No other objection? Motion passes. Okay.
As accommodating as you are.
He is. He's trying.
Make sure there's no tomorrow when it's good.
Item 29. Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay.
I've been just jumping in here, but we really ought to have to stop introducing these things.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and committee members, before you today, item 29 is Department of Administrative Services. This is a report. It is a report that's required based on some statutes that were revised and during the 2001 session. It relates to a reporting requirement that is to be made complied with whenever the department uses its administrative authority to refinance any debt to achieve savings. And Greg Jeffrey is here just to provide that report to you and answer any questions.
Welcome.
Madam Chair. My name is Greg Jeffrey. I manage the capital investment section of the Budget Management Division. Capital investment section is responsible for managing the various debt programs that DAS is responsible for, including the COP program and the lottery revenue bond program. As part of that responsibility, we continuously monitor opportunities to refinance any of the outstanding debt that the state, that the department is responsible for. We work with our financial advisor and the Oregon Treasury as a part of that process. At the end of January of this year, an opportunity was identified for some outstanding lottery revenue bonds. a refinancing plan was developed. The state treasurer has an interest savings standard in their administrative rules that require that the present value of the savings that would be achieved as a result of the refinancing need to meet or exceed 3% of the total amount of the bonds that are being issued to accomplish the refinancing. This test, you know, was determined to have been being met by the plan. Once the refinancing was executed, the actual savings amount to 3.55% of the amount of bonds that we did issue. The cost of the refinancing was a total true interest cost of 3.45% on the bonds that we did issue. All of the costs that we incurred in executing the refinancing were paid for with part of the proceeds of the bonds that we issued to do the refinancing. And as a net result of the refinancing, the total nominal savings that we're receiving, the state will be receiving over the next 13 years, amounts to $6.45 million. To put it another way, if you laid out the original debt service, you know, of the lottery bonds that we had originally issued, and right side by side look at the new debt service modified because of the refinancing, the net outcome is the state will be paying out $6.45 million less in lottery revenue dollars. That concludes my report, Madam Co-Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Did we didn't already budget this money, so this goes, is this ending balance stuff?
Madam Chair, this was,
no, this is spread out over
the debt service,
years. Never mind.
The debt service was budgeted. The $6.5 million that Greg has referenced is a savings over the 13-year term of the bonds. In this biennium, it's approximately $336,000. Those funds will not be allocated out to the agencies. They'll be maintained at DAS and available for distribution next biennium.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a brief comment and congratulate Jeff and the Treasurer on a very excellent program and for the scientific way about which they've gone through this process. This is $6.5 million that's available back to the education and other important things that we do with general funds or with lottery funds. So with that, I'd like to move that we approve and acknowledge the receipt of the report.
Okay. I've heard the motion. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, the motion is to approve and acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you. We do commend you. We'd like to see more of these comments. You want to carry it? Okay, Representative Butler will carry that one. Hi. I don't see you very often.
You'll see me for a while.
The next four.
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you tell us why we're all here?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a required report from the Board of the Public Employees Retirement System. We, during the budget hearings, we knew a new board was coming on, and the subcommittee and the legislature requested that about 60% of its operating budget be unscheduled or not allotted, pending a repeat report from the new board. The new board came on, was appointed, and took over effective September 1. The board has now submitted its report and it's here. So upon submission of this report, then it will go to the Department of Administrative Services for the funds to be rescheduled. We don't need to ask. The motion here is just to acknowledge receipt of the report, not to recommend rescheduling.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Brenda Rocklin, the director of the Oregon Lottery and vice chair of the PERS board. With me today is Lori Warner, the interim director of PERS, and Cora Parker from DAS. I am here today to present the board's report on our oversight of PERS operations. As Dallas mentioned, there has been a new five-member PERS board since September 1 of last year, so we've been in place for about 7 months now. All board members understood from Governor Kulongoski before we began this assignment that there was much work to be done and that our job was to actively oversee PERS. Let me make just a few general comments. First of all, this is a board that is actively engaged in the oversight of this agency. We understand that there is still much work to be done, but we believe we've made a good start. And the board also wants this committee to know that the problems that have existed at PERS for years are fixable, and this board is committed to fixing those problems over the coming years. And this morning, what I intend to do is highlight some of the progress we've made over the past 7 months. First of all, let me start with the relationship between the board and staff. With a lot of help from Lori Warner, the interim director, the board has developed an effective working relationship with the PERS staff. When we came on board, obviously the staff was used to the former board and how they interacted with the PERS staff. The staff has had to adjust to five new board members who have very different working styles. Since Lori Warner has joined the PERS staff, though, I would tell you that we are now getting the information we need to make the decisions that we have to make, and that the staff has been very helpful to the board in making important decisions. Second of all, I want to talk a little bit about long-range planning. Obviously, there is a lot of day-to-day work that the staff has had to engage in to get the work out the door. And I think today's Oregonian article is a good example of the difficulties this agency is currently facing because of the large number of retirements, an aging computer system, and 2003 legislative changes. That said, the current board decided it was important to step back from day-to-day operations and actually start to set some long-term goals and performance measures for this agency. So on a Saturday in December of last year, we spent a one-day retreat with PERS executive team members at the PERS office in Tigard and actually started working on some long-term goals. We revised the mission statement for the agency, set expectations for an effective working relationship between the PERS staff and the current PERS board, and began to set some long-term goals for the agency. In terms of budget oversight, as all of you know, the current PERS board did not develop the 03-05 budget. All of the board members, though, at this point have now had a chance to review that budget. We've compared that budget to the 2001-03 budget, and a number of the PERS board members have met individually with PERS staff to obtain more detailed information on how the budget was created and to more fully understand the particular expenditures that are in that budget. We have now implemented a new budget reporting system. We now get monthly statements from the PERS staff so that board members can track on a monthly basis the expenditures made by this particular agency and where we are over and where we are under on expenditures. You can expect the current board to be fully engaged in developing the 2005-07 budget, which is now underway. We have also been fully engaged in evaluating the requests that came before the November e-board and those that are coming before you today, and you have the board's assurances that we will continue to ensure that this agency operates in a fiscally responsible manner. Finally, I want to just touch briefly on a few other operational issues that are identified in the report before you. As I've said, there were a lot of issues facing the board when we arrived in September. We were obviously faced with a fairly steep learning curve, even for those of us who are members of the system. We believe, though, that we have developed an effective and efficient way of getting our work done, and let me just give you a few examples. First of all, in terms of litigation, as you know, we are currently facing a number of lawsuits in both state and federal court dealing with PERS reform legislation that was passed by the legislature the last session. Two of the board members who are lawyers work closely with litigation counsel for the board to get updates on where we are with that litigation and to actively weigh in on policy issues and positions that our counsel is taking. And we have monthly litigation updates from our counsel at our board meetings. In terms of rules, because of the large number of legislative changes that were made this last session, we have had to come up with a way to take a look at a lot of new rules that staff has been developing. We've done that by having board members assume a particular area of expertise and then work closely with staff on a day-to-day basis in terms of policy development on those rules. All of us are responsible for reviewing every rule, but having one board member assigned to a particular subject matter has helped us move forward with getting a lot of rules passed in a quick manner. And finally, in terms of internal and external audits, we've appointed one board member to work closely with the executive director and the internal auditor at PERS to make certain that we are following up on internal and external audit issues and moving forward with the progress that needs to be made in those areas. In summary, I would just tell you that the board values and respects the input and recommendations from the PERS staff on the issues that we are facing. But I would tell you that I think anyone who has seen the new board work understands that we are going to make our own decisions after carefully and fully considering all the facts and all the issues. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Motion
to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Senator Butler moves that we acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Carrier. Senator Harper would like to carry this.
Okay. I'd be excited.
That short window. Thank you. Number 34, Dallas.
Again, the Public Employees Retirement System is requesting limitation for issuance costs and debt service costs for certificates of participation that are scheduled to be issued this June. This is for startup costs of the new plan. COP authority was granted in the bond bill during the session. We also provided a dollar of limitation so that they could come back once the amount was known and the issuance dates were known for the limitation. So they're now requesting that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the acting director for PERS. Joining me is Dale Orr, who is the budget administrator for PERS. This request, as Dallas indicated, is for $2.3 million to cover the 03-05 costs related to the issuance of COPs to pay for the startup costs for the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan that was required by House Bill 2020. The COPs will be issued in June and run for 5 years if this is approved. Issuance of the COPs is a more cost-effective way to pay for these costs than other alternatives that the agency looked at. The COP rate is expected to be at about 2.9%. So with that, I would entertain any questions you might have.
Other questions?
One brief question. I assume those COPs will be paid for out of the general operating as of the standard other funds limitations over the five-year period.
That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the recommendation of legislative fiscal to increase the other funds limitation expenditure for PERS by $2.364 million.
Don't forget the $4.
And $4. We were going to put that in stamps. Get it in the mail.
Well, I had asked Dallas because the request was for $6.
You skip these guys for $2?
He has a good explanation.
He's always
read the report at the end of the report.
We already gave him the other two. But not to say that our folks don't look for for every buck that's out there. Okay.
I figured if you found two, you could find four. That's why they locked it off.
Okay. You've heard the motion. It's to approve LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
A carrier?
A carrier. I'll carry it.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And on to 35.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a request for $3 million in budget limitation to fund the third-party record-keeping services for the new individual account plan of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. That's the new plan that began January 1st. The contract was competitively bid through an RFP process and awarded to City Street of Boston. There were three bidders. The cost of the contract will be borne solely by the participants in the individual account program. The amount per participant is expected to be about $11 per year at this point, and that is basically the summary of that request. So if you have any questions, we'd be happy to respond.
Any questions? No? Okay. Is there a motion?
I move to approve the request for the $3 million.
Okay. Representative Butler moves that we approve the LFO recommendation for $3 million. Any objections? So ordered. Can I carry that, Representative Butler?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. 36.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, joining me is Mike Freese, the Deputy CIO for Information Resource Management Division of DAS. Her staff has worked closely with IRMD to develop the request that you have before you today. I'll briefly summarize this request, and then we're happy to answer any questions that you might have. The amount is for $2.7 million in other funds expenditure limitation. The first three components are interrelated. The first piece being the RIMS replacement phase one. The agency has tried to address the aging and deteriorating retirement information management tool since about 1998. The current system now has only about 50% functionality. This request focuses on planning and evaluation of the J-Clarity commercial off-the-shelf system. PERS would report to you again in June and in September, after this evaluative phase, about the cost, timelines, and use of this product. If successful, a contract would then be executed in November of 2004 and for an expected two-year replacement cycle for the RIMS product. The agency has spent the last 6 years working on this item. They've looked at a complete build project, looked at interim types of solutions that would be partial build, partial COTS solutions. This is basically a COTS solution to the problem that's currently being evaluated as the most timely and effective way to replace RIMS. It's $664,000. The second piece of this is stabilization and interim business relief. As you might expect, if the current IT tool is about 50% functional, staff have built other systems, workarounds we call them, in order to accomplish what they need to do on a daily basis. So we have databases that have been developed, spreadsheets, some hand calculations, and what this would do is spend some money on a focused way at looking at those tools to see if that those can't be improved, and allow staff to have some relief during the 2 to 3 year cycle replacement of what RIMS is going to take in terms of volume of work and those kinds of things. That's $700,000+. The third piece has to do with the data that's currently in RIMS. We know that that data has missing and inaccurate components to it. And this would begin to look at that data and try to clean some of it up, or look at ways that we might improve it in the interim and before transferring into a new system. That's some $656,000. The last two components support other agency functions, not dealing with RIMS. The security system part that's on here follows a formal information security risk assessment that we've had done that identified areas where we need to improve. In addition, we're working closely with IRMD right now in a statewide effort to look at security issues, and we will be prioritizing where we spend money with IRMD on the security improvements. The last piece is the telephone switch upgrade. This has to do with the fact that the current switch is unable to handle the volume of calls and lacks the kind of functionality to deal with the multiple requests that PERS is currently experiencing. This request upgrades and improves the functionality of the system. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very kindly. I appreciate that. This has been vetted thoroughly at the JLCIMT. It's my understanding that there was, I think the vote was 7-1 at that particular meeting. I'm just anxious to ask Legislative Fiscal, have you gone through in the Legislative Fiscal and examined each of the elements, for instance, the nearly $500,000 for telephone switching? I mean, we did that at our office for $15 a month. I just wondered what's going on there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll touch upon it, but I defer to the experts first. We gave them $250,000 during session. Do they feel that that is not enough? What is there now is severely limited. You know, we have approved the increase of staff of more than 100 people. The demands on the system have just made it impossible for people to get through at times, or even for staff to know in which order to take calls. There will be a lot of programming costs in addition to the hardware, but that we've gone through it. It's an estimate at this point, but I would...
I guess my concern, and this is what I would like to have addressed, Madam Chair, if I might, would be that it appears that when we get ready to tell the time, we start with metal to start smithing out some wheels for a watch. My concern is that industry has already gone through the process of developing the telephone systems that do all of these kinds of things. We're starting over to try and figure out how to develop telephone systems to do some of this, and that's the impression. So that's my concern.
If I might address that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Fries. I'm the Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and Representative Butler, we are not designing a telephone system. What this money is for is to take a look at, do a needs analysis against what PERS's current and predicted future needs are, lay that against the capabilities of the existing system, which we know is woefully inadequate. It just is not capable of handling either the call volume that comes in today, and it also lacks some of the capabilities that you would need to have in a call center to reroute calls, to deal with people that are on hold, and to produce metrics that allows the agency to determine how good a job it's doing responding to calls. So there are severe deficiencies in the existing system, and that's what this is intended to correct. It would be working with the telecommunication provider to put in an industrial-type solution.
I'm sure. I just wanted to make certain that this has been thoroughly vetted to the satisfaction of LFO. As I say, I know that it's gone through the JLCIMT process. So.
Well, I was going to turn to Dallas next anyway because his recommendation is different than the request.
Okay,
Madam Chairman of the Committee. Our request is, our recommendation is not to provide the additional limitation as per the original request. If you'll remember, in November, we unscheduled. We provided limitation and asked that it be unscheduled pending PERS coming back for when they develop plans. They have changed direction, if you will, with respect to replacement of the existing system and where they're going with implementation of things. We would recommend rather using that limitation rather than providing new limitation. The reason that we're recommending that here, what we recommended additional limitation for the two preceding requests. Those address different sections, different statutory limitations. So our recommendation is essentially to approve the request or the expenditure of these monies, but not from using additional limitation. We'll approve the use of it. Limitation has been provided, but at this point has been unscheduled by the Department of Administrative Services.
Senator Harper.
Yeah, and that's everybody's all in bed with this.
Yes, we're in agreement.
Okay.
But just if I could, Representative Butler's redoing his office for $15
a month.
You know, if he would have called me, I could have given him the cans, and he would just have to purchase the string. I got it down to $2 or $3. He should have let me know. I could fix it.
Well, and we didn't spend anything on the study because the phone company that's going to charge us the $15 a month comes out and tells us, you know, this plan works better than that plan. I just wanted to confirm that November, in November, when we provided the limitation and then unscheduled the funds, basically that limitation is still sufficient to cover this request, and your recommendation is to leave the funds unscheduled?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, yes. In aggregate, there was about $5 million of limitation that was unscheduled in November that hasn't been rescheduled. This would still leave some limitation there that would still be unscheduled, but there is sufficient unscheduled limitation.
But then it appears that the request is the Department of Administrative Services rescheduled at 2.7.
Yes.
Okay, that had previously been unscheduled.
Right.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would move the recommendation of Legislative yeah. Fiscal.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So, Representative Butler, I feel like we're loading you up today, and that's not really fair, but you actually understand all of this.
No, that's fine. I've worked
just
on this
in case there's questions. I've
worked on this for a few years, as you know.
Yes, I do indeed. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to number 11. Shuffle people. Hello there, Susie.
Can I bring it up?
Four left.
You're having fun now.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Co-Chair Harper, members of the committee. Again, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. And we've got four requests before you. The first one is a request to repeat a fire protection measure that we implemented last year, and it deals primarily with providing the funding to bring a heavy air tanker and lead plane from the state of Alaska down for our fire season, and in addition to provide us the authority to implement additional contracting and placement of resources should fire season become a severe concern for us. The funding to implement these two measures was approved last year during a budget session as a special appropriation under the emergency board, and with the provision that we would come back to the emergency board with these requests if we felt they were necessary, and that's what we're doing.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I just know how well this worked last fire season and saved the state millions of dollars, and I would move that we grant the request.
We have a motion to approve the LFO recommendation, approve the request. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay.
got off easy, Charlie.
Let's do that again.
Hey, there's three more here, so. Senator Messer would like to carry this one.
Change that name to Firebomb or I'll make it 750.
Okay, we're on to number 13.
Are the other three going to be this easy?
No.
I appreciate that. Again, co-chairs and members, the second item relates to a budget note that was in our budget to conduct a study of the viability of our nursery operation and report back to the e-board on that study. This was in response to some concerns from various interested parties expressing the view that perhaps our nursery program is no longer a viable operation. I'd like to ask the two members of our staff who conducted that to come up here with me in case you have some questions. If they're here, they haven't run out on me.
And yeah, I don't think they do that.
Oh, this is retired Deputy State Forester Roy Wu, working on a temporary basis a few months yet, and Southern Area Director Dan Schultz, they prepared the report. And I'll just basically summarize the results, and if you would like, they can provide more detailed information, or we can just simply answer questions. In essence, what our study leads us to believe is that we still have a concern that if we do not operate the nursery, that we'll be unable to provide reforestation seedlings for a specific group of people, those being small, non-industrial, private forest landowners who tend not to contract with commercial nurseries but basically wait until the last minute to decide they want seedlings. And it's generally been the constituency that we serve most consistently. Assuming that we want to keep the nursery for that purpose, we also enter into some contracts with Bureau of Land Management and some specialty growing with other industrial forest interests. And because of that, we feel like the nursery does have the potential to remain financially viable. We recognize that part of that is because we're benefiting from an insurance payment from the risk management, state's risk management program that covered the cost on some late season freezing that damaged some crops. But even with that, we think that once we've kind of pulled through that and brought our clientele back to where it has been historically, there will be the opportunity to operate the nursery as a financially viable, self-supporting enterprise. So I'll leave it at that. If you want more detail, we can ask Roy or Dan, or you can just answer questions.
Other questions? Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one prime question is, do you have any data showing the capacity of the private nurseries' ability to cover some of the market that you provide for?
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee and Senator Messerly, better identify myself again. Roy Wu, retired Deputy State Forester. I can share some averages historically of numbers and they can serve as an indication. We've identified roughly about 14 million seedlings as projected as needed for the non-industrial forest land owners. And that the nursery sells on an average annually 4 million of that. Okay. Now, when you add the total seedling needs historically anyway for the state of Oregon is 70 million. And that includes, you know, not just the non-industrial forest landowners.
What is it, 7 or 7?
70, 70. Yeah. And, of course, I have Dan Schultz here to kick me if I'm wandering off or misquoting numbers here. But
so far, you're
okay, thank you. now, the nursery produces 7.4 million seedlings that sold annually. And so the difference of 3.4 million is really what we call contract sales or seedlings that we grow under contract. And the importance of that is we need that as a revenue flow that we can plan on to operate the nursery. And, you know, if you want to cover the fixed cost, because when you grow seedlings for speculative or on demand for these non-industrial landowners, from year to year, you don't know if you're going to sell them all or not. because you're basically projecting historic or what you think is going to be needed. We do know that compared to the mid '90s and what's happening recently, there's just being less acres being planted. Primarily of a lot of factors, but you know, we all know that the federal agencies are not harvesting as much, therefore not as reforestation, for example. So I think that's probably enough information in terms of what we think the capacity out there, the difference, you know, than the private nurseries are filling. So we also know in our task force report that the private nursery over the years have grown or increased their capacity to grow seedlings, not just for the contract, but also for the speculative folks.
And I guess, Madam Chair, for a follow-up on that question, I was looking more for an answer as to, does the private sector have the capacity to pick up the slack?
You know, it's kind of a mixed answer. We believe that the private nursery has the capacity. In other words, the technology, the space. The question of us is from a profit. They have to make a profit. They're in the business to make a profit. In a high demand cycle for seedlings, will the private nurseries be able to provide speculative tree seedlings for all non-industrial landowners in a sustainable basis? Because of the risk involved in growing speculative seedlings, as opposed to when you're growing seedlings on a contract basis.
I may add a couple of thoughts. My name is Dan Schultz. I'm Southern Oregon Area Director. I supervise field operations in Southern Oregon on the west side, Lane County South, and the D.L. Phipps Nursery is in that in my area. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Messerly, really the niche of the nursery or the product that we provide that is not traditionally has not traditionally been provided by the private sector is an on-demand or speculatively grown seedlings. Non-industrial forest landowners harvest depending on market conditions or their own personal objective. They have someone going to college, retirement, something like that. They harvest or when the market's up. They're not able to or willing, possibly, to plan 2 or 3 years ahead of time, which it requires to have a contract and get your seedlings in the ground. So the nursery grows seedlings speculatively, which is a high-risk operation, sells about 4 million seedlings speculatively to the non-industrial folks over the counter to meet that need that they have on a year-to-year basis, depending on the timber market. If there is another way of doing that through the private sector, I think that's something that we're more than willing to work at and look at. So far, that hasn't been the case, especially during times when there's high demand for seedlings. It's much more profitable and easier, quite frankly, to grow seedlings on a contract basis and have those ready and sell those to the folks at contract for them, rather than grow those high-risk seedlings. The private nursery industry also grows some speculative stock, but it's usually by oversowing those contract those seedlings that they grow for a contract. The other thing that kind of makes it more complex is the number of seed zones around the state of Oregon. There's different seed zones, and mainly depending on elevation and whether it's Coast Range, Cascade Range, or Valley, that somewhat complicates it as well. And the nursery tries to provide seedlings for all the seed zones that people might need on-demand seedlings for. Well, maybe there's room to do some work with the private nursery industry to come up with a better way of meeting that need, but so far we haven't been able to get that accomplished.
Madam Chair, can I follow up
with a couple
more questions? How does the cost compare per seedling between your nursery and the private nurseries?
Madam Chair and the committee and Senator Messerly, our cost tends to be higher than what the private nurseries would offer the seedlings for, just because of the nature of the fixed cost that we incur. There's years, though, even then, that we both sell out in certain seed zones?
When you mentioned cost of your operations, actually there's two questions in this category. So the state nursery is self-sufficient based on the, well, now it's the insurance, but if the insurance wasn't there, could you sustain the production based on what you get for the seedlings?
Sustains.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Messerly, we've had some difficult times in recent years, with the main problem being the October 2002 freeze that pretty well eliminated most of our crop, and it took a few years to bring that back on board. The insurance will tide us over in the meantime. The short answer to your question is yes. Our projections show, and they're fairly conservative projections, on the number of seedlings we'll be selling over the next several years, is that by we'll run a loss in 2005, 2006, much less of a loss, and then 2007 we'll be back in the black based on our projections. There's several reasons for this. One is that the timber market seems to be turning around. Our non-contract seedlings that we're selling, in fact, this year we're selling over the projections that we had for those seedlings. Our sales to the on a contract basis to industry, because we're growing some specialized stock for some of the folks, has increased about double from what we had a few years ago. On the state forest side of the equation, because of the increased harvesting, primarily in northwest Oregon, the seedling orders from state forests are increasing as well. So all those factors together, we anticipate that by 2007 we'll be back in the black and running more than able to cover the costs. The all the revenue, I'm not sure Roy mentioned this, but the way that the cost of the nursery has been managed since the Elkton Nursery since 1957, and the state's had a nursery since 1926. The funding is all through the sale of seedlings, not from, there's no general fund involved or other funds. Yeah.
Madam Chair and members of the committee and Senator Messerly, I would also ask that the nursery has reduced their expenditures significantly by reducing staff and going with contract services instead of payrolling our primarily in the seasonal employees. We historically have employed, I'm just rounding numbers here, about 100 seasonals during the busy time of the nursery, and we have essentially contracted half of that labor to save costs. There's been also other cost reductions that we've done in the nursery so we can be competitive, if you will, as a business.
Absolutely.
I see the carrier.
What do you... You won't want me to carry, maybe.
Yeah, well.
When you analyze your cost of production, does that include all of your depreciation, maintenance, management costs from the state office, and everything, or how do you? I mean, can you compare it with what a private sector would their cost would be?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senator Messerly, our costs include the overhead costs, if you will, that contribute to the agency. They include all the costs of services and supplies, the maintenance of the facilities, everything that's necessary to maintain the nursery operation, come through the sale of seedlings. Including vehicles, radios, any of the training, all that comes out of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You guys made the statement that this niche market, you didn't think the private sector could step up to the plate and fill those orders. I guess, you know, in 57, that might have been a fair statement, but today we have at least 39. I'm a little skeptical as to where that information comes from, or how you really can make that statement.
Madam Chair and member of the committee and Senator Harper, have some data here I'll share with you, but before, just quickly, it has changed significantly. Once again, the private nursery stepped up to the plate in providing ceiling for all landowners. But our records show 1999 through 2004, on average, what we describe as low-demand seed zones, meaning sales of less than 100,000 seedlings a year, that there are six zones, and at four of which we are our nursery, the only provider of seedlings. Now, that number, when you add it all together for the six zones, is 186,000, in which we provide solely 2,000 of that.
So you're going to get us that, Roy?
Yeah.
Or you just did?
I just did, but
okay.
I can follow
that's
up.
Yeah, that's all right.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to make sure, I think Dan's word is it's really more complex than maybe it sometime comes on, but it has changed where the private nurseries are doing more, but we still have seed zones that are not being provided by one source.
Is it worth our follow-up, Madam Chair? I guess I said 39 private nurseries in today's environment. Is it worth our while for you guys to sit down over the next 6 or 7 months with the industry and figure out a way to fix this problem? It seems to me that you could focus your efforts in on other, you know, primary functions of ODF and let this nurse and let this seedling thing be taken care of. And if we were comfortable, bring it to the next legislature with a recommendation or an idea. But I think that would be useful, a period of time spent. But right now, the most is just to accept the report, basically. But
and the report's all we get to deal with.
Yeah,
but
so
I agree with you. When we started this program, there weren't many out there doing it. And really, we were dealing with specialty trees that most folks didn't raise in those days. And that's not really the case anymore. But I was curious. Last October, there was a freeze that killed most of your nursery stock. So what exactly are those folks who were going to buy those trees going to do now?
Madam Co-Chair, that was in October of 2002, and some of those needs were filled through the private sector, people going to other locations. In some cases, they weren't able to plant trees when Phipps was the only provider for those seedlings, and they had to hold them over for another year. So it did have an impact on ability to reforest in some cases. That was the case also on some of the state land that we've got. And hold over for another year.
Okay, they will be able to meet their obligations under the Forest Practices Act, and some of them bought them from private nurseries.
Yes, in fact, there were occasions where we provided an exception to the Forest Practices Act for a person because they couldn't get the seedlings.
People who waited to the end of their 2 years to decide to plant.
Yeah, and that happens.
There's only so much you can take care of.
Madam Co-Chair, member of the committee, for conversation's sake, I Senator Harper's suggestion. I've talked to some of the folks who represent the private nurseries, and that would be something that we'd like to do, is take this time between now and your regular session and work together. Matter of fact, the task force recommendation was that the nursery, ODF, and the private nursery people develop a relationship where we can figure out how best to meet the interests of the state of Oregon. Not necessarily ODF's or the private nursery's interests, but the state of Oregon's need for seedlings. And we'd like to do that. And I would add that a couple of other points. Douglas County is very interested in this conversation because they recognize the employment opportunity that our nursery represents in an area that's economically challenged. So, matter of fact, Stan mentioned, and I guess in the late 50s, the county actually helped the department acquire federal soil bank grant money to acquire the lands in which our nursery is in. So the county is going to be an important piece that we need the time to work with, as well as we need to evaluate our other services that the nursery does, and that for example, we're a key partner with the OSU Nursery Technical Co-op in providing research support and educational assistance. So, again, I think this would work for us.
Yeah. Other questions? What's in common?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can say that representing counties that have double-digit unemployment, and I appreciate the fact that there is some unemployment in Douglas County, but we'd like to have those kinds of jobs too. If you want to start raising juniper and sagebrush and its various varieties for our zone. But I just wanted to make certain that I understood that there are six seed zones, and that now at least some of the private nurseries do accommodate all of those six seed zones within the private nursery stock?
Currently, there are six seed zones that we define as low demand. Four of those zones, our nursery is the only supplier. The other two, yes, there are private nurseries that's also supplying seedlings.
But given the opportunity, given the opportunity, there's no, we know of no reason why the private nursery organizations couldn't provide those for those four that there are low demand, that there are no seeds produced by or no seedlings produced by other private nurseries at present.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, and Representative Butler, our concern with that dialogue, and this is why we need the time to work for the private nursery, is will they do that sustainably, particularly in a high-demand seedling period where contract seedlings are going to be the more profitable mode. And I'm not saying they won't or can't. I'm just saying that we need to work together to convince each other that can happen.
Follow up. Roy, you've indicated that the cost of production to the consumer, those products to the consumer, is higher. Do you know by what percentage? Are we talking about 1% or 2%? Are we talking about 30%?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Butler, off the top of my head, I think it's about, it varies, but I think on the average about 10%. Significantly higher for the non-contract speculative stock because there's more risk involved in growing that.
10% average.
Yeah, I'd say that's a reasonable average.
Okay. Follow up.
Go right ahead.
I'd like to know what's being done with the excess inventory. You're basically growing for the spot market at that point. What's done with the excess inventory when nobody steps forward in certain seed zones and those kinds of things?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Butler, they're basically plowed under at the end of the year, or otherwise destroyed when they're not saleable.
And do we know how many seeds that are, how many seedlings that is, that are plowed under?
I can get you that information, but I don't have it right at my fingertips. It's a significant number some years, depending on the seed zone.
I guess, Madam Chair, my concern would be to know. If we're going to make this on equal footing, I come from a part of the state where we look across the river and watch what they do in the state of Idaho. And what they do is they have a free seedling day when everybody is through planting, and they know that they're going to have excess. And there's some beautiful stands of trees that have come from those free seedling days. And that would be, if it's a public service, indeed, as opposed to plowing those under. The final question I had was with regard to the DAS risk management costs. By submitting these kinds of insurance claims, do we have any idea what that's done to the overall risk management costs, and are those kinds of insurance awards going to be available to us in the future?
Member of the committee, Representative Butler. We no longer have crop insurance through DAS risk management, and as a result of this, the significant claims that we've had from primary one in October 2002, there is an impact on the agency in increasing our payment to offset those claims back to risk management. And in fact, because the state of Oregon is self-insured, there's somewhat of an impact to other agencies too from that. But we are anticipating paying more from the agency and more from the nursery operation back on those premiums that we'll have to pay in future years, yes.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that what's going to happen here is that we're going to go ahead and accept the report, but that there's an understanding between
at least this subcommittee and the state forest folks that they will come back at some point in time with a recommendation, having assimilated information from both private and public and those kinds of things. Now, when I looked at this and the information that I've received, it looks to me like that this is an excellent opportunity for us to go ahead and start leasing this opportunity, this nursery out to private enterprise and let them try and go ahead and do some of the things that we've been doing. But I'm wondering is, if we accept the report as recommended, can we go ahead and put the stipulation that we would accept the report with the stipulation that the work group be formed immediately and that we receive a report by the January 05 e-board so that we'll be able to proceed with some kind of legislative understanding of what might happen with regard to the D.L. Phipps nursery?
Two things, Representative Butler. One, we have Mark Simmons in the room, and it would be nice if the committee would agree to have him come up, since he represents private nurseries, and get his perspective on it as well. And yes, staff has given me a note that we can accept the report and put some provisions in it that they report. Now, Susie was saying report back to the next legislature, but you make a good point. If they come to the January emergency board, then we'll be ready to move next session, mm-hmm. as opposed to getting it during session.
Yeah,
so I don't think there's any reason we can't do that. Is
okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would close, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that we are very sensitive in competing with private nurseries. When Representative Butler mentioned free seedling days, we got our tails burnt one time doing that kind of stuff because the private nurseries, you know, here we are giving away seedlings in which they could sell their seedlings for. So just want to just say that we're sensitized to that and we're more than willing to work cooperatively to meet the state of Oregon's interests here.
Free lunch.
Thank you very much.
Are we going to hear from
Mark? Let's bring Mark. You want to come up?
I'd like to, you know, and in that process, perhaps Dan or Rory or somebody could be thinking about what kind of who the members should be of their work group. And maybe Mark could address that as well, I'm sure.
Well, and I don't know how specific we can get since we only started out accepting the report. Okay. We can just tell them that they need to report back to us on their progress.
Madam Chair, thank you. I am Mark Simmons, representing the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We do share the concern with the Department of Forestry that adequate seedlings are available to reforest as needed, when they're needed, in Oregon forest lands. We support very much the Forest Practices Act that we have and want to ensure that there are seedlings available. However, times have changed dramatically since the D.L. Phipps nursery was first established. The nursery industry has matured, and we believe that the nursery industry has the capacity to handle the demand. We have had an initial meeting with both the department and industry groups as well, and they're concerned that seedlings be available in times of both high and low demand, as had been mentioned, for all seed zones and all species. We share that. Also is a concern that if there are any changes in the supply chain that did not cause any lapse in timely reforestation on our timberlands. And we also share that concern. And we would be pleased, very pleased, to work with the department and any others who have a concern about this issue to see if the private sector can, in fact, fill the whole bill.
Right. Are there any questions? Senator Messerly.
I think it's important, Mark, to get this on the record because there is more risk when you deal on the speculative market. Is the industry willing to absorb some of that risk that the state is absorbing now?
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, private growers are growing on spec today. I don't have the quantified volumes as of yet. What volumes are they growing on spec? But I've talked to a number of growers, and they said, yes, we are growing seedlings on spec today.
I guess I'd ask the same question, Madam Chair, relative then, Mark, at the end of the season, those that are grown on the spot market, speculation, are they just plowed under by the private nurseries?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, they are either made into compost, fed through the chipper, or in some cases, if they can be, you know, cold storage only lasts for so long, they have to do something with them. They do dispose of them.
But that's pretty much the same with, I mean, you could growing petunias and have the same thing. If nobody wants petunias this year, you're going to plow them under.
Give Butler a half a dozen pine trees and get him off your back.
Duly noted.
I'm not going to get
the one that I got last year.
You got to water them.
Madam Chair, with that, I would make a motion then that we go ahead and accept the report with the proviso and with, well, let's see.
Susie, could you offer some suggestion here for us?
For the recommendation.
What you're asking is that the agency get together with representatives from the private industry and
others that you know,
and whoever else they think may be helpful and come back to us with a recommendation to January e-board on the future of the state nursery.
That's my motion.
Very good. Okay. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Carry on.
Seeing no volunteers, I guess I'll carry it. And you'll all explain it, right?
Yeah,
if there's any questions.
That's one of these.
Yeah, you did it. Welcome back.
Madam Co-Chair.
Okay, we're on to 16.
Yes, ma'am. The next request is a request for 23 positions for our state forest program. Provide some background and rationale on that. As you know, it's been an ongoing discussion about our state forests and how they're managed and what level of harvest responds to the revenue expectations that the various beneficiaries have. A result of that was, as you know, a budget note during our last budget session that was approved. The budget note indicated that we should carry forth on various projects that we felt like we needed to implement to get better information, to get more informed on reviewing our management plan, but that in the meantime that we should operate at the high end of the harvest level. Once that budget note was approved and finalized, it was my direction to go back to it was my decision to go back and direct the staff to look at what that meant to the highest level we could. And I did that because I felt like the message that I got very consistently from the legislature when they prepared that budget note was that they were concerned about the revenue contribution that we were making and that felt like it could be more. And so my interest was making sure that you all felt like we were being absolutely responsive to that concern. The staff did a good job. They pulled together the figures to indicate that within the context of the management plan that we have and that we want to try to maintain, they could conceivably develop sales plans for another 50 million feet above what we had planned. In order to implement that, then we went back and reevaluated all of our staffing and implementation strategies and provided then to you this request for 23 positions. Ross Holloway is here again, the program director, and Steve Thomas, assistant state forester. For State Forest, we can provide more detail, or we can start answering your questions.
Senator Masselli, a few minutes ago I told you that what you were saying was something I was going to come back to with another agency. And
I think I figured out where you were talking.
This is it. I felt last session that we had an agreement. We spent about a month on your budget, and you weren't here for the whole thing, and I'm not sure if Deputy Director Wu has left us or not, but he was here for most of it. And we had all kinds of experts from forestry, from industrial landowners, from all over the place, came in and told us what we should be doing. And I thought we had reached an agreement on the level of harvest that we were going to have and that the budget notes covered that.
And what I am most dismayed with was to find out that after we left, then there was a meeting. Meeting I certainly didn't know anything about. I would bet nobody on this subcommittee knew anything about, or on that original subcommittee knew anything about, in which there was a request made to you to increase the harvest. That what we had discussed in subcommittee and what we thought we had agreed on wasn't good enough. And so as a result of that, that you reconfigured your sales so that you are now going to be harvesting other acres where you can considerably increase the clear cut. Now, that's a forest practices strategy that you certainly can make. What I am really upset with is the fact that I thought we had become partners over about that month when we were struggling through that budget, and that we had some understandings. And just as angry as I got when you went out and cut a side deal on salmon anchor habitat without involving your partners, I feel like the same thing has been done here. Not knowing that that was done, I've been out trying to explain the budget note for the last 2 months, and now understand that my explanations probably didn't make a lot of sense to the people I was talking to, because I was talking about a whole different outcome than what the department was actually doing. So I am really frustrated, as you can probably tell, over this. You have partners, and one of my biggest issues last session was that you needed to work closer with the counties. They are your main partner. And now I'm telling you that I think you need to work just as closely with any committee or any member of the legislature that works, that you have some type of agreement and working relationship with, and that when we walk away from the table, we can all reasonably expect that that's what's going to be carried out and that we're not going to be off with an agency doing something else. Because I don't know at this point who the heck you're going to cut the next side deal with, and that scares me.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I appreciate that. I understand why you feel that way. I would want to correct some impressions, if that's okay. And I'll be the first to plead guilty to the fact that we didn't talk to you all the way through on this one. I got the message on the salmon anchor habitat. I thought we were doing pretty good, but I'll admit to stubbing my toe on this piece of the issue.
Salmon anchor habitat, and you only were there for part of this one. So.
Well, the other part, the impression that there was a deal cut, and I want to be very clear on this. There's not been any deal cut, and there wasn't any request to do more. There was a meeting, and
there was no request from that meeting to harvest more trees.
No, if you're talking about a meeting with Representative Shetterly, I initiated a discussion with him after the session was over, as he was the sponsor of House Bill 3632, for the purpose of talking to him about legislative concepts that I thought would be valuable discussion items for the next session and might avoid the kind of conflict that we ran into with House Bill 3632. I told him that my goal in all this was to be able to continue to implement what I thought was a really good plan, that I heard the concerns that various people had expressed and wanted to engage the legislature in a discussion about various concepts that I thought would get us past 3632 and really talk at a policy level about what those lands are for and how they benefit the state of Oregon. And I told him that I also wanted you all to know that I was willing to be absolutely responsive to the concern for revenue that you had. And I told him that with that, I thought that we could make a move to move our harvest up to 250. I wasn't asked by him or anyone else. That's what I volunteered. And I did that, like I said, because I started in the middle of session last year. One of the comments that I heard pretty frequently was that your staff aren't listening. And I wanted you to know we were listening. Maybe I listened too well, but it was my decision. and my decision alone.
Other questions?
I had one question. Thank you very much. The increase from 200 to 250, how does that compare to what for 2004? How does that compare, for instance, to 1974, 84, 94, 10, 20, and 30 years ago? Do we know what the numbers of millions of board feet were harvested at that time?
I'll ask Ross if he's got an idea there.
Thank you. And again, for the record, I'm Ross Holloway, the director of the State Forest Program for the Department of Forestry. Chair Dukes, members of the committee, Representative Butler. We do have some historical volume information. I think it is part of the package. In the early 80s, the harvest levels were probably in the 220, 230 million per year range. They dipped significantly with the combination of the markets and also and then the listing of Alzheimer Letts in the early 90s. And we have about 10 years worth of data in the reference in the handouts. 111 million board feet were harvested in 1996. That trended upward, and in 2000 we had 266 million board feet. These are statewide numbers, and in the same handout in the line below, we have numbers for just the Tillamook and Clatsop portions. But essentially, the volumes dipped in the early 90s and then started trending upward again and are now at levels that are higher than anything that I have records for in state forests at the current level and the proposed level for the coming fiscal years.
So, Madam Chair, just to follow up. So if we were at one point in some of the trend up harvesting from these state forests, 266 million board feet, what were we doing relative to employees? Were we putting on additional employees at that time, or were we making do with the employees that we had?
The trend on the employees, and then I'll put it in terms of full-time equivalents, in 95-97 biennium, we had a little over 200 full-time equivalents in the program. That did increase up to a high of 255 FTEs in the 99-01 biennium, and is actually, 255.8 in the 01-03, and it's actually decreased since that time. So we did top out in 01-03 with authorized positions in the program, and actually lost some positions in the last session through vacant position reductions that occurred late in the session. We had requested in the last session a number of additional positions for the increased forest levels in the forest management plan implementation, and that was what led to the discussions of the subcommittee that we had, and none of those requests were approved at that time.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess where I'm coming from here, and I realize that even with the advent of the computer, it takes more people today to harvest these trees. My concern is if we went back 20, 30, and 40 years ago and took a look at the harvest rate, they'd be much higher than the 250 million that we're talking about today, and we did it with many less employees. And my concern is that we're spiking or anticipating some spike, and I'm still, until I see the first additional stick run through the mills, I'm still pretty skeptical about the whole process. But I'm still anxious that what we're doing is we're adding quite a number of additional staff to take care of things that we didn't have to have staff for when we were regularly producing much more than what we're producing now. Thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions?
We have a motion.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me back up. Let me take care of something I need to take care of. Commissioner Tim Josie is here from the counties, and he came all the way to talk to us about this. And so if the committee would agree, I'd like to invite him up. I apologize there, Tim. I saw you walk in, and I had it. My mental notes don't stick as well as they used to.
I really wouldn't have been all that disappointed.
Oh. I keep keep emphasizing that you are their first partner. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that. For the record, I'm Jim Joseph, Tillamook County Commissioner, and Tillamook County represents, in terms of land base, about 50% of the state forest lands, trust lands. And so Clatsop County represents, as you know, 30%. So between the two of us, if you add it up, that's 80%. We have most of it, and so we have a lot at stake. I'm also the chair of the Council of Forest Trustland Counties and also the chair of the Forest Trustland Advisory Committee. The Forest Trustland Advisory Committee is a entity lodged in statute that's advisory to the legislature, to the Board of Forestry, and to the state forester. And I bring before you today the two handouts, a resolution, and it was passed and it was signed, but I don't have a copy of the signed version. This is a resolution the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee.
I think that's probably pretty good.
We worked on this resolution for some time during our last meeting, which was dated March the 19th. Ultimately, all of us voted for it. It was a unanimous vote to support the additional positions. And then the other document that you have is something that I wrote that went out last week to our local paper. It's a commissioner's column, and just want to highlight one of the paragraphs. The additional 50 million board feet per year will generate about $15 million per year in additional revenue to the state, counties, and local taxing districts. About $7 million per year of this will flow to school districts, and much of that will act as a state general fund offset, as you know, freeing up general fund dollars for other critical needs. The additional timber harvest is expected to generate an additional 450 to 750 new jobs in the rural communities of Northwest Oregon and the adjoining region. It's very important to us. And the new positions, the point that is not on here, most of these positions are going to be lodged in the rural communities. These are family wage jobs, and so it's going to be a real boost to our economies. And so I wanted to bring this message to you that that the trust counties do support these positions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Miller.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
This will generate about $15 million per year in additional revenue to the states. Is that just from the sale of the logs, or is that including the revenue that will be turned by the 450 to 750 new jobs? Is that an additional amount you expect? Or?
I think it's information that I obtained from information from the Department of Forestry, and I believe it's the difference between 200 and it's the additional 50 million board feet per year.
But actually, it'd probably be a lot better
than this.
In terms of the 450 to 750, you've got new jobs. Those people might make it down to the local restaurant and local hardware store, and the money will keep churning.
If I may, to put the 250 in perspective, first of all, the counties were not involved in this decision, as you know. We, and I am the chair of both entities, we did not discuss this, and so we were not part of this this decision. However,
the decision is what I was saying about earlier. You were part of the budget discussions that led to the forestry's budget and the budget notes. I mean, you were in the loop for that.
Just to give you a little history, and I apologize for not saying Madam Chair, and I'm not as formal as I should
see,
be.
See, they leave the building and look around.
Yeah, I know. Not wearing a tie either. When we were developing the forest management plan, we ran several computer models. We called them the Dr. John Session models, and we ultimately agreed upon Alternative 1C2. And Alternative 1C2 was really, all of the models were developed for comparative purposes. And that model showed that we would start off at about 279 million board feet per year, and then there would be a dip in about 10 years as we regenerate the Douglas fir that were taken off because of the Swiss needle cast. But eventually, in about 70 or 80 years, this is a decadal model that went out 200 years, about 70 to 80 years from now, we would get to a sustainable harvest for the Northwest Forest of about 350 million board feet per year. I call that the promised land. And so we, the counties, spent a lot of time working with the Department of Forestry, the Board of Forestry, and the timber industry, and our partners, and we agreed that alternative 1C2 was what we should shoot for. Then the draft implementation plan was developed by the department, and that at that point in time, it became very evident that not adequate attention was paid to the lack of growth because of Swiss needle cast. And so they came up with a figure of 149 million board feet per year. We promptly hired a timber consultant, Mason, Bruce, and Gerard, and we've been working with them. And we've gotten, we, working with the department and the legislature, got a commitment to bring that up to about to 200 million board feet while we work through this process. It's called the H&H Project, Habitat and Harvest Modeling Project, very in-depth analysis of the forest out there so that not only will we know what we can harvest on a sustainable level, but how we can do it and obtain the desired future condition of our state forest lands. And through structure-based management. So when you look at the 250 million board feet per year, the message that I'd like to give you is that although the counties were not involved in the decision to bring that up to that level, it's still less than what we thought we were going to be getting when we agreed with the Board of Forestry to the Forest Management Plan, which would have put us at 179 million board feet per year. Or 279 million more feet per year.
Questions?
I have a question for LFO staff. The positions which you've recommended here, even though your recommendation is based upon limited duration, positions, as I go through and look at some of these positions, and these are all timber sale contracts, and I notice that you have several administrators for timber sale contract administration. But when I see folks like road specialists and engineering and surveying coordinators and assistant reforestation folks, there's a handful of them, and reforestation technical support, I'm looking at that and I'm saying, wait a minute, if we're selling this timber on contracts to private parties, I just say, that looks like that's a private job to me that ought to be part of the contract.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the kinds of positions that the department is requesting are the positions that they need to do the prep work for the contract to take place. And they have increased their plans to contract as much work as they can, and they feel that they have reached the limits of what they can, at least at this point. They are also going to engage in a pilot project in the Clatsop County, I think, or Clatsop Forest, to do additional contracting work and see how they can, if they can do some of this other work by contract. But by and large, this is the work that these are the kinds of positions that the agency needs to do the planning work to get to the sale. And I don't know if they have more to add to that.
I guess that's totally legitimate, but then once you enter into, I'm not sure why you have reforestation folks that are hired up front in order to just let a contract, and I would expect those
Butler,
to be part of the contract.
I'm not recommending those positions at this
time. Okay, all right, thank you.
Those are positions the department will have to come back later because they come more towards the end of the process.
I guess what I was waiting for, Madam Chair, was LFO's recommendation to find out, and I appreciate the fact that you're saying, hey, these are limited duration to bring into the contract, then just include road building and road building specialists and engineers and so forth as opposed to having those added as under the Department of Forestry, have those added as part of the contract obligations that those folks, as part of their reforestation, will provide all of those, or as part of their harvest and reforestation.
And Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I would expect the department to bring a policy package to the next legislature during their budget presentation to identify what permanent positions they are going to need for ongoing harvest activities, that they're going to be able to sustain the higher levels based on their harvest habitat modeling efforts that they're doing, then they will need to identify what that resource is that it's going to take to do that. And at this point in time, as they have identified the two forests where they can increase their harvest levels, and they are going to need additional staff to get to that level. So that's why the recommendation isn't the full 23 positions, but the ones that will get them to that point.
Kind of a final question for LFO, if I may, Madam Chair, and that would be that I would like to see what, and I recognize that back perhaps in 1964 or 54, there wouldn't have been, when we go back 50 years ago, but there probably wasn't reforestation specialists and those kinds of things that would have been required. But I would like to see what our volumes out of the state forests were at that time in relationship to the numbers of employees. And then, you know, with shock and awe, take a look at what we've done to ourselves in mandating all of these other positions, because I'm sure what's happened was that, you know, we were able to produce hundreds of millions of board feet with very few employees, and now we've limited ourselves back. When we take a small incremental change, we're looking at 23 permanent employees. It was a request. So I would like to have just a little bit of history on that. Thank you.
I think that's a good point, Representative Butler. I have to point out that the Tillamook, after going through three separate fires, wasn't exactly online at that point in time. But nonetheless, a comparison of employees versus production.
Point well taken, Madam Chair. Let's not let it burn again.
Million board feet divided by folks.
Yeah.
Simple ratio. Just. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the LFO recommendation.
Okay. Senator Harper moves the LFO recommendation. Is there
it's
any
understanding
other questions?
It's a total cost of one position and a decrease of almost one FTE and a zero expenditure limitation. So I think it's a pretty good analysis, pretty good compromise in what we have here. So yeah. I'd like to move it.
Any questions, discussion? No? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Carrier?
Oh, well, we'll flip the choice.
It's your forest. It's
my forest. Exactly.
I take responsibility for this animal.
All right, one more. Number 17.
Yes, Madam Chair, we've got one more. This one relates to implementation of Senate Bill 360, which deals with a program to address wildland urban interface and fire prevention measures. Our request is for four positions to be.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Our request is for four positions to be reauthorized from other programs. In essence, we want to make this FTE neutral and no additional request to the general fund, but we feel like they're necessary to satisfactorily carry out the program. Assistant State Forester Charlie Stone is back again, and he can answer any questions you have about that program. So.
Proposal similar to the last one, a put and a take from the fire program, you know, back and forth, so plus four, minus four, you guys, everybody's comfortable with this activity, so pretty good idea, it seems to me. Any other questions? Chair, move we accept the LFO recommendation. Any discussion? Further discussion? Any problems? Okay. So ordered.
Carrier.
Senator Dukes, yeah. Teacher, yeah.
It's obvious.
And is it? We're done, right?
We're done.